coolest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Who's your
Tuber
Tuesday.
Double the Riff Rock.
Double the Riff Prizes.
Learn it, know it, live it.
Tuber Tuesday on the Riff. From 101 WRIF.
If it rocks.
If it really rocks.
Now, begin transmission.
Here comes the music.
Riff.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
Mike tried to get through a review of some art house flick, House of Sand and Fog. Yeah, there's a big budget thriller. Anyway, the Peanut Gallery had a pretty short attention span for this one.
Her dad had this house. She ended up getting the house, and she never opened her mail. And eventually the city took the house from her. She's trying to get the house
boring.
Back. And basically these foreigners moved in and they built a porch higher up so that you could see the water in the distance, and they called it a water view to double their money.
Boring.
And that movie was playing in the theater. It was flooded with Old Milwaukee, and strippers were drowning in it. I wouldn't step foot inside. Seriously, my wife would need a roll of duct tape and a wheelbarrow to get me to that one.
There's that vicious suicide in the end. I think it's like the Comcast On Demand or something.
If you superglued my genitalia to a cannonball and fired it through the front door of this theater, you couldn't get me to see a second of that.
I would rather wear a Sally Jesse Raphael's panties like a ski mask
to see this film.
I would rather pack my full of M80s and squat over a flaming hibachi than see this movie.
Wait a minute.
I would rather have a circle with my dad and grandpa to see this flaming turd of a movie.
Drew and Mike in the morning. Broadcast program.
On the Riff.
101-101.
Riff. Rocks.
Now is the Riff's Rippin' Rock at 9 o'clock. 1 solid hour of your Riff rock and roll request.
All the excitement and fun you can bear.
With Meltdown, the big unit.
All you do is talk about the economy. Hey, right now, zero people are on the line. So if you want to talk about something else, I'll talk about what I want, all right? But also, the same thing goes for you. If you want to talk about something that you think deserves to be brought up to, and now we have an international audience. So you might not want to talk about a street light broken. That Detroit Public Lighting Commission just won't fix my light. No, I don't think that's going to work. 313-298-WRIF. The Democratic convention is beginning in Boston. A little preview of, I think, what we're going to see in New York. In other words, it's sort of a mini police state because, wow, you never can tell when those terrorists are going to strike. And it always looks to me more in these situations, and I'm going to talk a little about this as I talk about what I'm calling dirty laundry. It always looks like it's an excuse to make sure that people do not see the demonstrators. That's really what it's about. Also, if you're far away or don't have access to a phone or just don't want to talk on the air and you want to make your opinion known, you can email me at calltalkyes. That's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you write a real long message, I'm not going to be able to preview it, so I probably won't read it. I'll read it after the show. And so best maybe no more than a short paragraph. PeterWerbe.com is my website, PeterWerbe.com. Now, here's what I'm calling dirty laundry. Usually you're not, and hey, if you're any of my bosses are listening, it's nothing about the station because you wouldn't do that. If there was any hassle here, there is no hassle, but if there was any hassle, I wouldn't talk about it on the air. If there was something going on in my family, I wouldn't talk about it on the air. That's too private. So this is dirty laundry really that involves the, in some ways, some of you who call the show, who listen to the show, who email me, who are as virulently anti-Bush, who think that George W. Bush and his regime have taken us down a road that the United States has never gone before, that we are so badly on the wrong track that this raises images of almost the Civil War. Not that I think a Civil War is going to break out, but that kind of contentiousness, this kind of mistakes in national policy. So, George W. Bush came to town on Friday, and a number of organizations called for demonstrations against Bush. One of them was the NAACP. extraordinarily large chapter here in Detroit, maybe like 50,000 members. The Service Employees International Union, SEIU, another big union in our city, and a very progressive union, very important union, good folks. And also anti-war groups like the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War, against war in Iraq. I think they've changed their name. War and what's the? I think they changed the I or something. Anyways, so there was thousands of emails put out. I sent out maybe several hundred to my list. And when the smoke cleared, you know how many people were out there? I've heard 200 people protesting Bush. I even tend to doubt if it was that much. Could have been very much more, like 150 people. Now, and this is the dirty laundry. I mean, probably I just either should have ignored this, but I'll tell you, the media all ignored it. There's a little short thing in the Detroit Free Press. The New York Times coverage didn't mention the fact that there were people out there protesting at all. This is in a city that voted over 94% for Al Gore in 2000. And yet, when it comes to taking ideas and transforming them into action, everyone stays at home. Now, I know a lot of people were working. It was a work day. The demonstrations went from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. But, you know, he comes to other cities. When Bush came, let me think, this was like in February of 2003, came to Grand Rapids on a weekday. 2,000 people showed up. Now, I don't know what's wrong with Detroit. I don't know what's wrong when, oh yeah, and there was a couple people from the Detroit Common Council. There was a couple of ministers there, all of who participated in trying to get people to take this opposition to George W. Bush and make it manifest. The word in French and Spanish, I don't know French very well, but and barely Spanish, but it's manifestación or something like that. So it's a manifestation of your ideas. A lot of us think, if everything in our head makes sense, that we can look at George W. Bush or Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld or the rest of them and know they're lying. We know that they're scamming us. We know that they're, as I said, driving this country down a dangerous and incorrect road that free people would want to go. We say, then it's okay. I'm not being fooled. I can watch him. I can watch Fox Hole News. I can, all of that. It just washes right over me. So I am safe from the dominant ideas, at least they're presented out of the dominant political structure. And that's enough. Well, it's not enough. And some people say, well, I'm going to get out in November and I'm going to vote against George W. Bush. You know, it's funny. You don't hear too many people saying they're voting for John Kerry. In fact, the Democrat strategy, I think, is just to let the Bush regime collapse of its own weight. I mean, it is just plummeting in popularity. And, well, it should, of course. I mean, even what they said they had bragging rights to September 11th and the war in Iraq, of course, is now just literally down the drain for them. But if you don't respond, if you don't put your body out there, and it's not like, you know, you're going, you're demonstrating in China or something like that, and someone's going to shoot you down. I mean, all the cops in Detroit are against Bush, right? The mayor is against Bush. The Common Council's against Bush. I mean, this is anti-Bush territory, yet he felt perfectly secure in coming here and speaking. I'll tell you, they evaluated this, and they probably said, what's going to happen if George W. Bush comes to Detroit? What's going to be the opposition? And they probably thought, well, those lame balls in the, well, I shouldn't say that. Never mind. I'm not putting it up. I was going to say the lame balls in the anti-war movement. That's, you know, the anti-war movement itself is not huge. What happens? The movement itself, the activists itself, themselves, they plan demonstrations and then we respond to it, or not very well. So, as I said, Portland, Oregon, 25,000. I'm talking about a little town, like, you know, around our size. Not New York City, where a quarter of a million or half a million will come out to protest the war. We're talking about a relatively, a town of under a million. So people like Karl Rove, the guy that runs the political scam out of the White House, they probably said, what do you think is going to happen? And they say, well, maybe 100 they'll come out, maybe 200 at the most. You know, they're correct. If they would have thought 25,000 people, if 5,000 people were going to be out there, they wouldn't have shown. They wouldn't have come to Detroit. They didn't want that kind of bad publicity to see a whole city, or at least a large number of whole city, or a large number of people representing the city out there. And instead, there's this nice smiling photo of George and somebody from the Urban League. It says, Bush urges black voters to question party. Well, that's, I mean, I don't mean that they shouldn't, but what are they going to do, vote Republican? There was also a counter demonstration. This was very surprising. In fact, when a friend of mine and I came up to Hart Plaza where the anti-Bush demonstration was going, I said, hey, this isn't bad. There's about 400 people there. I mean, that's good for Detroit, right? I mean, 25,000, you know, but 400 here, you lower your expectations. Turns out about an equal number of people, maybe a little less, 125 people, were pro-Bush. They were pro-Bush. I never saw anything like this before. And I think what's happening is the Republican Party is mobilizing these Christian fundamentalist churches. Most of them, most of the people in the pro-Bush group, just look no different from the people in the anti-Bush group. But there was this ragged edge of people that of real anger and real kind of weird stuff. I mean, there were like some 13-year-olds just with these angry faces, and they were like chanting pro-Bush, you know, George Bush, four more years, like that. Except they were just seemed very extraordinarily angry, and I'm trying to think, what is going on with these people? So I asked a couple of them, what do you like about Bush? And it's kind of like this article in the New York Times. They said things like this. Said in Beckley, West Virginia, thousands of people came out to greet Bush. And Jim Farnsworth, a 32-year-old telephone technician, he's getting robbed by the Republicans. All this money's going to Bush's corporate buddies, right? And he's, I voted for him last time, we'll vote for him again, and would even vote for him a third term if he would run. So what is appealing to Jim Farnsworth? He's, quote, I like the convictions he stands on, abortion, comma, family. That's it. And his wife chimed in, his belief in God. So, the fact that we just went over 900 U.S. GIs dead, thousands of Iraqis dead, billions and billions of our dollars are just bleeding out of our tax money, and people are getting laid off more and more. He's going to vote for him because of abortion, comma, family. What the hell does that mean? Family. I mean, have the Republicans really been able to sell themselves, even with all this scandal they're always involved in, that they actually have, quote, family values? Or is there anything in their program that anything and any legislation that would actually show family values? Everything erodes families because it erodes the income of the middle class and the working class and destroys the poor even further. Well, here are a couple of things. A friend of mine, he was talking to a police officer, or he was standing there, and a cop said, you have to get over there. And he said, why? He said, that's the free speech zone. You ready for that? And he says, I thought everywhere in America was a free speech zone. He says, not when the president's in town. And I was standing looking at these people, trying to get kind of a bead on who they were, the pro-Bush people. And this Detroit cop comes over me and says, you belong over there with the pro-Kerry people, with the people for Kerry. And I said, I'm not for Kerry. And they said, well, then get in the line here if you're for Bush. I said, I'm not for Bush. And he says, well, what are you doing here then? You don't belong here. All right. Third story. I'm looking at these pro-Bush people. They're extraordinarily conservative. And here is this woman, probably in her mid-60s, waving a red flag. What does a red flag stand for? Well, danger, but communism, right? It's the communist flag. There's even, do you ever see that old Charlie Chaplin film, what is it, Modern Times, when he picks up a flag from the back of a truck that was a warning sign, starts running down the street, and suddenly hundreds of workers are following him. They think the revolution's here. So the red flag of communism, that's all it is. I've never heard. So so this woman comes around, and I said to her, why do you have this communist flag? And she's like, ah! You know, I can't even do it. I won't be able to talk. She starts, like, screaming at me. Unintelligibly. And so these I let her go a few down, and I asked these other people in the Pearl Bush, I said, why does she have a communist flag? And they shrugged and smiled. I mean, they seemed good-natured and all that. So she came around again, and I said, come on, lady, you got a communist flag. Why are you in this pro-Bush group? And so she starts, like, kind of gesturing with the pole that's on at me menacingly. So I said, wow. So I figure, well, anybody nice would have just left. But I figure, well, maybe I can send her over the edge. So she comes around, and I said, lady, you have a communist flag. Why? And she says, this flag is the blood of Christ. I went, whoa, that was the one answer I hadn't expected. But then I realized that these were these mobilized fundamentalists that they'd got here. So these folks had this thing about blood. I just don't know what to say. It was kind of scary. Anyways, put your ideas into action. If you don't know, and a lot of people don't know. A lot of people say, I didn't know there was a demonstration. There was a demonstration downtown. Look at my website. Go to mecawi.org, mecawi.org. Check this out. If you want to be an observer of history, if you want to be the object of history, that is something that is acted upon, do it. All right, but you can be the subject in history. You can become an actor. Masses of people acting together in common have been the motor force of history. Not always. Sometimes great men create history, usually badly. People don't want bad things. Strong men, leaders, politicians, militarists, they're the ones that always have these grand ideas of conquest and war and power and what have you. Us, the common people, what do we want? We want to be able to live in peace with our families. That's why Thomas Jefferson wanted democracy for all countries. He said there would never be a war if all countries were democratic, because no people would ever vote to go to war against one another. All right, that said, 313-298-WRIF, call talkyes at yahoo.com. A little later in the show, we're going to be giving away DVDs, another film by Mark Akbar. Mark Akbar is the director of this film that's playing at the Maine, The Corporation. We gave away DVDs for that last week, didn't we? Or we gave away something. Oh, no, we got the DVDs this week. Last week, we gave away passes and a T-shirt and a book. That's right. All right, so now this is called Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky and the Media. That's C-H-O-M-S-K-Y. And Noam Chomsky, probably the most known linguist, intellectual, and political activist. So if you never heard of him, check him out. One thing I want to ask people, though, this sounds nuts. This was sent to me by who? Joanne, she says, and I don't know, Bush misspeaks in an interesting way. It says, Newsweek, and I don't know where this is quoted from, it's from Forum Host. It says, Newsweek reports that President Bush, appearing before a Right to Life rally in Tampa, Florida on June 17th. This could be a totally made-up thing. It sounds so crazy. So I'm not saying this is true, but I need some of you to check this out. Tampa, Florida, June 17th, President Bush states, quote, we must all remember that all human life, all human beings begin life as a feces. A feces is a living being in the eyes of God, who has endowed that feces with all of the rights and God-giving blessings of any other human being. Close quote. The audience listened in disbelief as the president repeated his error at least a dozen times before realizing that he had used the word feces when he meant to say fetus. Now, we've come to believe that the man illegally occupying the White House, the one who stole the 2000 election through his daddy's friends, could say anything stupid beyond belief. But this is beyond belief. So I'm just saying someone reported that. I need some corroboration, someone to say, yeah, this is true or it's not true. All right. And so we'll be giving away the DVDs in a little while. Stay tuned for that. We'll do it at like 11:30 Eastern time and at 12:30 as well. All right, let's start. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Doing well.
Oh, cool. I was wondering what you thought about it, and I wanted more people to really know about the Proposal M coming up here on August 3rd.
I'll tell you, I must be out of it. What's Proposal M?
Proposal M is for medical marijuana in Detroit.
Oh, in Detroit, yeah.
Yes, and there's our editorial in the very back of the Free Press the other day, and it's kind of dogging on it and gave a real bad impression, and they really claim they're only, what they're saying is the reason why we shouldn't have it is because the risk of malpractice claims. I mean, I really don't really get how somebody's going to ever get a malpractice claim for prescribing somebody a couple of joints. I mean, that is so ludicrous.
Well, also, I don't know what the, maybe, I can't really talk too long because your phone is breaking up some, but yeah, it's medical marijuana is on the ballot in Detroit, and I hope it wins overwhelmingly. People are compassionate and understand that how marijuana can relieve a lot of different symptoms of both medication and diseases themselves. John Ashcroft, of course, has raided. I mean, that's why some of these people that are dope smokers, and they're going to vote to bring back this government that has an attorney general that instead of fighting terrorism, raids hospices where people are dying and smoking marijuana to relieve pain or the pain of chemotherapy and nausea from chemotherapy. And he's sending feds in to make criminals out of patients. So everywhere this has come up for a vote recently, it's won overwhelmingly. And people can do it on their own. In other words, you don't need a doctor to say you need a couple joints.
Do you think that they're actually giving us a legitimate shot at what's going on, or are they just letting this go on because they know we have our right to do this, but they've already made up their minds that there's no way that, you know, they're ever going to do this?
Who's the they in all this?
I'm just saying, like the government, who's out, you know, deciding whoever's making the laws.
Okay, well, we are going to have to cut this short because you are breaking up. I don't know. I mean, the drug laws are an enormous racket that provides, again, steals billions of dollars from our tax revenues that we should be using for constructive stuff and puts it into this war against a citizen's right to put whatever they want into their body. So let's hope it wins overwhelmingly. All right, thanks a lot. 313-298-WRIF. Anybody, I always say with this audience, I suspect that people overwhelmingly support the libertarian view that the government has no right to choose or deny us intoxicants or certainly health related substances like this. So I will take calls that people that can come up with a reason why we shouldn't have medical marijuana, why that resolution shouldn't pass. Hey, by the way, I want to say thank you to Todd Evans, who's the city editor of the Ferndale Pleasant Ridge Mirror, the newspaper there, the weekly. They did a very, very nice interview with me. And if you want to see what I say to questions like, do you believe in ghosts? And what do you like on your pizza? It's in the Ferndale Pleasant Ridge Mirror. But thanks, guys. Thanks to, I don't remember Dennis's name, a wonderful photographer that did a little shot of me as well. All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. Hey, you with me? Sounds like a no. All right. Okay. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Yeah. We've got Bush landing here at our little airport in Waterford.
Yeah, Bush what?
You know, he landed in his little airport out in County Waterford.
Oh, that's right. He did, didn't
he? For his private party.
Yeah.
The way I see it is bringing, you know, with his Hatfield and McCoy family argument, the Bush is against whoever you want to put it, whether it's Bin Laden's or, you know, whoever they claim is their enemy. I just don't think he needs to be taking this little airport and showing up and being, you know, it's just like he wants to be Big Shot. And then L. Brooks Patterson shows up there and greets him right at the plane. We got to rename the airport Brooks Patterson Airport.
No, they're not doing that, are they?
I hope not. I mean, they probably will, but I got to talk fast because anytime soon a plane's going to go over the lake here and I won't be able to hear you. You know, you won't be able to hear me because they're bringing in bigger planes.
Well, Air Force One actually could land at the Oakland Airport?
They did bring in three different planes. They brought in one of the smaller ones. I don't know if you know that airport, but we've been fighting expansion for years. But yeah, the guy comes in, the president comes in for a private party, you know.
Is this, the Pontiac Airport out on 59?
That's right, Pontiac. Okay. It's now called an international. They made it international, so now we've got...
Cool?
Yeah, well, no, not cool.
Okay, uncool.
Airport. little lake community. We're the lakes community, and we got these jets coming in and buses, air buses.
Oh, man, yeah, I could see that would be terrible.
Well, it just seems like if he, you know, don't come into my community and be a target because, you know what, I own a lot of property here and I don't want to be irradiated. You know, if there's going to be a strike against him because he, the Bushes are a target. I guess in a sense it's just a feud that goes on and it's just,
although he hasn't carried out the feud very well, has he? All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Yes, I just wanted to ask you a question. This is going to be like kind of off topic.
Sure, it's okay. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think on your views on like the video games that are coming out now? Do you think they should be taken off the shelves for protection of younger viewers? Or
well, I think that's an interesting question, but I'm going to have to plead supreme ignorance on this. I don't think I've ever played a video game other than, I'm dating myself, I realize, Pac-Man. So what are they like? I mean, they're super violent and all that now?
Yeah, they're starting to come out with these games that you could, like, rip off your opponent's heads and whatnot, kind of like Mortal Kombat. And I told you earlier that this question was kind of, like, off the wall because you're kind of an adult, and I just wanted to get an adult.
Well, what do you think? I mean, so I'm totally, I don't have kids. So I mean, if sometimes parents, they see this stuff, and they do have opinions on it. So what do you think? Well, I mean, you answer your own question. Do you think there should be some sort of supervision of them?
Personally, I don't really care for it, so long as the child understands that that's just there for entertainment. And sometimes, like, I say that in, like, school debates, and they just look at me crazy. I'm the only one that ever stands up for that, though.
Hmm. Well, you know, it is interesting what you have a steady diet of in terms of images. And if all of our images are violent, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, most people that see violent movies, most people that play violent video games, I mean, 99.9% of them function totally normal and don't act out and what have you. But it is kind of curious that that is this form of entertainment. I mean, I saw a violent movie. Well, actually, it wasn't that violent compared to most movies. I saw I, Robot last night with Will Smith. And now that I think of it, there was a couple trickles of blood, and I don't know, only one person got killed. Maybe it's not even violent. All right, well, so I'm out of it. We can see what other people think. Thanks for raising it. You can always go off topic. I'm not as ADD as the worst, but I'm close enough. So that never, a train of thought, I don't even know what it means. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. John from Ann Arbor.
Hi, John.
Couple of things. First of all, I did have Friday off, and I could have been at Hart Plaza if I had known about it. You mentioned that you had some sort of a mailing list. How come I'm not on it, and how can I get on it?
Well, all right, all you have to do is email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and say you want to be on my mailing list, I'll send you out notices. Yeah, I didn't send one out for this show. Where was I this week? But anyway, I usually send out a little note, and it'll give little bits of information, even sometimes stuff I don't mention on the show, And so it's got some value to it. But you're right. I think part of it is a lack of communication, even though, I mean, when you talk to people, they say, I mean, everybody I know sent it out to hundreds of people on their mailing list. You would have thought my mailing list would have been enough to get more people than actually showed up.
Yeah, well, I think that the good guys, that is the left, needs to be better organized.
Yep.
Now, the other thing I wanted to tell you, you might have seen this. This was on the front page of today's Ann Arbor News, attributed to the Associated Press. W is ahead right now in the electoral vote count. And it turns out, according to this article, that only 11 states matter for the presidential election and campaigning. Those are the only states where they're spending money on TV ads and visiting the state physically. And Michigan is one of those 11, but the rest of the country, they don't matter. And I think that says something about this so-called democracy.
Well, I was trying, while you were talking, I was paying attention. I can do more than one thing at one time, but and I couldn't find this right away, but I think it was on truthout.org, And there's a refutation of this idea that Bush is way ahead in the electoral college.
I'd love to see that. I'll look at it. Then there's one last thing. Here in Ann Arbor, just within the past week to week and a half, all kinds of campaign signs have been popping up for the August 3rd primary. And there's one from a guy named Wahlberg who's running for Congress. And on his smaller signs simply say, Wahlberg for Congress, which I always think is such a waste because that doesn't tell me a thing. But the bigger signs say, pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, and then it says in big, bold letters, conservative. Nowhere does the word Republican appear, but twice the elephant logo is on this sign.
Well, John, I think that probably that's a hint. But let me tell you this, that there are a lot of people that run for Congress without ever mentioning party affiliation. Usually what it is, it's someone, if you're a Democrat and you're running in a heavily Republican district, you do that and reverse. Although I tend to think that it's mostly Republicans that do it.
Yeah.
John, I got to take a break. Thank you so much for joining us from Ann Arbor. I agree. We were talking about not very many people showed up at this anti-Bush demonstration on Friday, and there always is the communication problem. All right. What we're going to do, I want to get these phones filled. Is line 5 working? Is that... all right. Let me do this. When we come back, I'll tell you how we're going to give away this DVD that is called Manufacturing Consent. It's about the media. Noam Chomsky and the media is the name of it. Well, I guess that's a clue that it's about the media. Also, a little bit about the 911 Commission and more of your calls. Be right back.
Your opinion matters. Call 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call and more of your calls coming up.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. Hey, it's late night. You're sitting there and you're thinking about your mortgage. Well, you can go to rockfinancial.com right now. That's right. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can go to rockfinancial.com. And there's a lot of reasons to visit. Find out how you can get a $200,000 loan for a lower payment than you would ever think. Also, find out about the Smart Arm. Maybe you're not going to be in your house that long, and you've got to take a look. If you're like most Americans, you might have $7,500 or more in credit card debt. Might be time to use the mortgage and consolidate that debt. No reason to have outstanding bad debt like credit card debt when you can have good debt, low interest, and tax deductible. Use your mortgage. Go to rockfinancial.com right now. You can check out the mortgage calculators. See how much home you can afford if you're thinking about a new purchase. A lot of reasons to go. So go right now, rockfinancial.com. Even though it's late, you go to rockfinancial.com. Anytime, anywhere. Evenings or weekends, you can go to rockfinancial.com, Michigan's largest mortgage company, rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company, an equal housing lender. Details at rockfinancial.com.
Citizens of Michigan, now that I've fixed California's problems, let me tell you something. I want to help all of the people get a new car. So if you have a job and $199, Dick Scott Kia in Canton and Dick Scott Kia of Waterford will terminate your past credit problems.
Do you have a job? Do you have $199? Then you could be approved at Dick Scott Kia in Canton and Dick Scott Kia of Waterford. Brand new Kia Rio started just $7,899. That's just $7,899. Plus, every new Kia is backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. Now, you can tell your past credit problems.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Make every mile count only at Dick Scott Kia. Michigan Avenue, a quarter mile west of I-275 in Canton. And Dick Scott Kia of Waterford. At the Summit Place Mall on Elizabeth Lake Road, just west of Telegraph. Call 866-6-KIA now. That's 866-6-KIA-NOW.
Qualified buyers plus tax, title, and plate fees. All rebates to dealer.
My name's Mike Chapek, and I think outside the bun.
Mike Chapek thinks outside the bun.
They do free popcorn refills at the movies, so I fill up on about 6 tubs a show.
Mike found a refilling loophole a mile wide.
You bring your own empty duffel bag and slide them in one at a time.
Mike gets more for less. That's why he loves Taco Bell's new Big Bell Value Menu. From half-pound burritos to big double tacos, it's loaded with affordable items that let you say, I'm full.
Now I'm making my backpack waterproof so I can fill it up with soda.
Stick it to the man, Mike. When the economical are on empty, they keep their stomach and wallet full with Taco Bell's new Big Bell Value Menu. Because they think outside the bun.
Half-pound burrito claim based on average weight. Individual product weights necessarily vary. Double taco claim based on comparison to Crunchy Taco.
Craving a taste for late-night excitement? Taco Bell is open late so you can feed your need for all the spicy, melty, crunchy stuff you crave. Spice up the night. Think outside the bun. Open till 2 a.m. or later. Hours may vary by location.
More Night Call with Peter Worthy. Next on The Rim.
Get ready to meet Keratine. The Triple Max Tour. This Friday night at 8, Meadowbrook Music Festival on the campus of Oakland University.
That cool look like the Wendy's chick, you know? You pull in the drive-thru and like, damn, she's here! Clean up! Wendy's in the drive-thru!
Keratine. Bringing his trunk full of laughs to Detroit for one show only.
How about a little Slurpee cup with translator books so you know what the hell the guy behind the counter is talking about? 7-Eleven.
Keratine.
You want to have a great time? Order pizza from Domino's and then dress up like them when they bring the pizza to your door.
High voltage rock and roll comedy.
Carrot Top.
You open the door, you're like, you know, say, Jordan Pizza Dude. You're like, Jordan Pizza Dude.
Everywhere. Be careful not to miss him.
Here's my favorite one. It's a boot with a kickstand, though, so you don't fall down when you're drinking too much in a bar.
This Friday night at 8, Meadowbrook Music Festival on the campus of Oakland University. Your tickets are on sale right now. Palisnet.com, the box office, Ticketmaster, charge by phone 248-645-6666. Get ready for Carrot Top. Coming live.
At Chrysler, we'd like to salute all the automotive suppliers who've helped build our most amazing lineup of vehicles ever. Whether you manufacture modular door panels or state-of-the-art carbon fiber taillights, you played an important part in our success. So now through August 31st, your local Chrysler and Jeep superstores would like to salute you and over 600,000 of your automotive supplier colleagues with an extra $1,000 in bonus cash on select Chrysler and Jeep vehicles for a total combined cash allowance of up to $6,000 when financed through Chrysler Financial. You can choose from the new Chrysler Pacifica, PT Cruiser, the trail-rated Jeep Grand Cherokee, and more. We realize all the hard work you put into making Chrysler vehicles some of the best in the world. So talk to your human resources department or contact your dealer to see if you're eligible. If so, we have $1,000 in supplier bonus cash waiting to put toward the Chrysler and Jeep vehicle that you helped us build. But hurry, this offer ends August 31st. So get to your Chrysler and Jeep superstores today. Jeep is a registered trademark of Daimler Chrysler.
I am an American soldier.
I am a soldier in the Army National Guard.
I am a warrior and a member of a team.
I serve the people of the United States and live the Army values.
I will always place the mission first.
I will never accept defeat.
I will never quit.
I will never leave a fallen comrade.
I am disciplined, physically and mentally tough.
I am an expert.
I am a professional.
I stand ready to deploy, engage, and destroy the enemies of the United States of America in close combat.
I am the guardian of freedom.
And the American way of life.
I am an American soldier.
I am the Army National Guard.
Defend freedom. In the Army National Guard, you can. Visit 1-800-GO-GUARD.com today.
Sponsored by the Michigan National Guard. Aired by the Michigan Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, more of your comments, questions, and opinions with your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Man, they need those National Guard ads, don't they? I mean, people aren't thinking that's the best place to be any longer. Well, we got to take care of some business. Now, here's what we're going to do. My apologies to all of you that are waiting on the line because you're not going to be eligible for this contest. And I don't know any other way to do it. There's six of you waiting, and there's tens of thousands of people listening. So I guess six have to suffer. I'm sorry about that. Anyways, we're going to give away the DVD, Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky and the Media, this film by Mark Akbar. And he's the one that co-directed the film that's out now at the Maine, the Corporation. Now, we were talking about two subjects. One didn't get discussed on the air, but I brought up this whole subject about this demonstration that was pretty small in Detroit when George Bush came to town on Friday to talk to the Urban League. And I thought this was almost disgraceful. It was a scandal that in a town like this, George W. Bush wasn't met by 25,000 people saying, get out of town. Politely. Not mean. Well, here's Jacob. He's listening in Oulu, Finland. That's right. He's listening in Finland right now. Well, the sun never sets there, I don't think, so I don't know. I can't even imagine. What time is it there? Like 4 in the morning? 6 in the morning? Anyways. Hi, Jacob. He says, he's listening on iTunes. Oh, he says, 6 a.m. Monday morning. I'm doing morning drive. So some of you say, hey, you're on. You're nothing. You're on late Sunday night. Well, in Finland, dude, we are the morning show, right? I got to get a female partner. Jalene Jordan, are you listening in Miami? I'm going to get you back here. Anyways. He said, I like your introduction to this week's program. The real problem about demonstrations is to keep a protest movement motivated, and that means each protest has to put a specific focus, not just a general statement of anti-war, anti-Bush. The specific focus has to keep changing, pardon me, so that the groups that come out are not bored about coming out every week or every month or the same issue. Well, I think that's one possibility. Now, let me see. Some other people had comments on that as well. This is Carl listening in Maine. He says, new online listener. I'm enjoying your show online for the first time from up here in central Maine. I really like your website, too. That's peterwerbe.com. P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E. Has lots of great links to explore. It looks like I'm going to be busy for a while to re-defeat Bush. What he means by that, of course, is that Bush lost the first time around. And let's see, Gary writes, I'm happy to hear you mention the lack of support at the recent anti-Bush rally. We know that tens or hundreds of thousands oppose his radical agenda in cities all over North America and the world. What's disheartening is that these same people don't voice their opinion when they have the chance. In a crucial moment in history such as this, it's a shame that the masses don't bother to show up. On the flip side of the coin, the demonstrations in Boston and New York this year will be bigger than anything anyone has seen before. Well, Gary, I don't know about Boston, but I certainly think that's going to be the case in New York, where I'm going, there for the Republican National Convention. The other thing that I mentioned was that Joanne had sent me this link, or this this email, about this Newsweek report where it quoted George Bush as saying, we must always remember that all human beings begin life as a feces rather than a fetus. And it says the audience listened to disbelief as the president repeated this error at least a dozen times. Well, thank you to Waggy, Roy in listening in New Mexico, and Dave who sent me, and I would have done this myself. Whenever you hear anything strangely suspicious, and you should always be suspicious, go to Snopes.com, S-N-O-P-E-S, Snopes.com. Snopes said, this is false. This item is nothing more than a fabrication which plays on President Bush's reputation for making verbal miscues. No such report about his speaking at a Right to Life rally and repeatedly misusing the word feces in place of fetus ever appeared in Newsweek or any other publication. I think it's interesting, though, that so many people believed it. I mean, that's what's interesting. All right. Just real quickly now. Let's do this. I've been talking too long. I was going to start talking about the 911 Commission report, but I have a bit to say, so let's do that at midnight. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. Hello. Did you get, let me see. I got everything pushed? Okay. I don't think they are there. So I'm going to just say goodbye to them. Where are we going? Line 3? All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi. I was calling in response to the person that called about the video game.
Sure.
Now, I've seen something on TV about the ratings that they put on the video games and how they need to maybe adjust some of the ratings. One of the video games they addressed, I'm not exactly sure what the title of it was, but it was a baseball game, and it just seemed ridiculous to me, the content that was in it. It was rated everyone, and they had a big E on it for everybody. And this woman and her child were sitting in the living room, and she was playing it. And he was running around throwing balls at people, and you could, I mean, actually get in fights with the other players. And I really didn't see how any of that related to real baseball or why they would need to put that in there.
Well, if you saw the Red Sox-Yankees game, you would understand how that would happen. Yeah, I don't know. So, do you have any children?
No, I don't.
Okay. So, have you played video games? I've never even played them.
Yeah, well, I used to play them a little more than I do now, but mm-hmm. I do have a younger sibling, and it doesn't necessarily affect him by making him violent or anything, but I think it kind of numbs him to the fact that sometimes this does happen, stuff like, you know, there's violent stuff that goes on around him, and sometimes I think he doesn't, he might not react the way he might if he didn't play the video game.
Well, it does give the impression that blowing people out of the sky or killing your enemies is a very cool thing.
Right, right.
Yeah. I suppose if people are your mortal enemy, just by the adjective, you're justified, unless you're a complete pacifist, in taking definitive action. But I don't know. We've been really ramped up in terms of our worldview of fear and violence, and I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what it all does to people, and I don't want to come on and say, we got to take away video games from everybody because it prepares them for war. I don't know whether it does or it doesn't. Maybe it does in some people. I'm sure it probably doesn't in most. In fact, our phone screener, Dan Letarski, says he plays video games, and you're not ready to kill people, just at least not tonight, he says. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Do we have our winners yet? Okay, if you're calling in, you call 313-298-WRIF. The next several callers will get a copy of the DVD, Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky and the Media. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
How are you doing?
Good.
I'm a little bit nervous. I've been listening to you since the 80s. I graduated in 87, lived in Detroit my whole life. And it's not what I called about, but the video game thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a release for a lot of people. It's like people been blaming music and videos and video games for making people violent.
Sure. That's what I was thinking. You know, that that used to be, since the beginning of rock and roll in the 50s, it was always said it creates teen violence and it does this and it does that and it can, you know, suicides and whatever else, yeah. Right? So I'm a little suspicious of it, yeah.
But actually, the reason I was calling you is about Bush. It scares me the way his administration has passed ruling after ruling to hide what they're doing, which I find incredibly suspicious, and that people don't find it unsettling that their leaders would want to hide everything.
Well, I think the people that know about it find it extraordinarily unsettling, but when you start telling people that Dick Cheney has this secret energy meetings that he doesn't want to tell who was at it, mainly because Ken Lay and the Enron people were writing our energy policy, it's extraordinarily unsettling, but most people don't go that deep into things.
One of the first things he did when he came into office, which I don't know if you've I've been listening to you, like I said, for years, but I work midnights now, so it's hard to call you. I'm at work normally.
Mm-hmm.
And every 12 years, after you're out of office, they're supposed to release all your records. And
right.
One of the first things he did when he came into office was cancel that. So Reagan's records were kept secret when his father was vice president.
Yeah, and of course,
it never made the mainstream news.
Well, it didn't. I mean, I saw it probably in something like the New York Times, but I'm sure it was never in the Detroit Free Press or Detroit News or anything
like that. Most people should say, why are you doing that? Why are you hiding the things when your father was vice president that happened?
Well, his father, you know, claimed he had no understanding of one of the worst illegal, unconstitutional scandals in American history that took place during the administration of one of the worst presidents we've ever had, Ronald Reagan. It's going to be actually a toss-up when Bush gets to the end. Who of his term in a couple of months, who's going to get the nod as the worst president? But Bush Sr. always claimed, he was out of the loop, right? He didn't know
right.
that this criminal violation of our Constitution was going on, that we were selling arms to Iran, right?
Cancel all the records, so his denial of being out of the loop can't be illuminated.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, thank you so much. Thanks for listening. Still talking about that reason why people didn't respond to an anti-Bush demonstration. And this is Kenny listening on the Internet in Santa Rosa, California. He says, my view in the matter is that it isn't necessary in a city like yours that is so dominantly against Bush to protest his arrival. They don't have to convince anyone. There is no one they need to convince to vote for Kerry instead of Bush. This actually reminds me of a conversation I had with someone at the gay pride parade in San Francisco. He basically said the whole thing was pointless and San Francisco is the most gay tolerant city on earth. That's why the gay pride parade has been getting smaller each year for a while. Well, it could be. On the other hand, Kenny, the New York gay pride march, I think, had a million people in it. By the way, somebody else said that there was this AP story saying why Bush had a lock on the electoral votes. Dave in Ann Arbor writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com that he said there's a story titled AP Story Giving Bush Electoral Lead is Faulty. It's at DemsOnline.net, like in Democrats, Dems. DemsOnline.net. That's the story that I saw. All right, we're going to line one. Dan, all right, thank you. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Peter, how you doing tonight?
Doing good.
Thanks. First of all, thanks for the show. You keep me busy at work.
Great.
And I have two comments. First of all, the red flag waving lady at the protest.
Mm-hmm.
I can really totally relate to that mentality. My parents are a lot like that, and I have a lot of trouble understanding it. But the thing is, I got in a good debate with my dad the other night. He was watching Jeopardy. We all were, the family. And a Kerry ad comes on, and he starts fuming, and you know, he just yells at the TV. I haven't heard one. Let me think about this. I haven't heard Kerry say one thing about what he thinks about God or abortion. And those are the only things my parents vote on. And I've tried to talk to them, but they just don't seem to really care.
Well, I talked to somebody here at WRIF, fine person, a good colleague, and she said she would, because of her religious belief, she said she could never vote for anybody that was pro-abortion. So I don't know what to say. I mean, I guess you have to really ignore a lot. The economy, foreign policy, education, the environment, workers' rights, taxes, all of that, and say, well, at least he's anti-abortion. Well, he's never going to do anything about it. I mean, this country is not going to abolish abortions. So it's kind of a ruse in a way. I mean, if Bush, for instance, the people thought that the Supreme Court justices were going to resign and let him put in somebody who was anti-abortion or what I call compulsory pregnancy. And yet, I'm sure they were said that the president doesn't want this, that they don't want to get in the middle of a big catfight about abortion rights or the right for a woman to choose. So this is going to be, they're never going to deliver on their promises. So they're voting for a phantom and against their own economic interests, against their own environmental interest, on and on.
I totally agree there. The other comment, I turned 18 this spring, and I went to register to vote the next day. And I wasn't aware of this at the time. I thought you registered party with a local party, but apparently you register your party when you register to vote.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no options of parties on my registration form, and my friend had the same problem as well.
You know, I forgot even how that works now. Some states, are you sure Michigan has party preference? Someone will have to tell us. Because in the past, there's been people that have crossed over. They voted, particularly Republicans, will, when the candidate is sure on their side, they'll vote for the Democratic candidate they think would be most likely to lose. Mm-hmm. Try to get not the best Democratic candidate, but the worst. So, I don't know. Someone can call in and tell us. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your comments. Randy writes in from Kalamazoo. He says, sorry to hear there weren't more protesters out for W's visit to Detroit. When he came to Kalamazoo about 2 months ago, we had a billboard along I-94 taking out that read, Iraq, how many deaths? With images of women, children, men, soldiers, all in silhouettes on it. We also had people lining the roadways and just under 1,000 people protesting across the street from Wings Stadium, where he spoke in the so-called free speech zone. But he saw us, and he couldn't have missed that sign on the highway. We made him aware, even in this, the highly Republican part of the state. We don't want him. Now, that's what I'm talking about. About 125 people come out in Detroit, and Kalamazoo has 1,000. What is up with that? I don't know. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, checks and balances. You know, like quality control, it seems like we should be able to monitor government. We have the Internet. It's like instant. Why don't they have a website that lets us monitor what's happening in government, so we could be informed? You know, everybody has computers.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can kind of do it ourselves, but it takes some extra effort.
Well, like C-SPAN, you can watch C-SPAN, but you can't respond or something. It needs something. It seems like they're working for us, so we should be able to have input. I mean, you can attach an amendment or things. I'm not too up on the language, but a bill would be passed, and then they attach things to it, and then therefore it gets voted down because someone attached the wrong things. We should be able to, as a people, see that happening and put it almost an instant vote or get in touch with the people that are on were their constituents or whatever. We should have a voice. Gore created the Internet. Let's get it working for the people.
All right. Kind of instant democracy by Internet. Well, it'd be a change. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We'll be right back. We'll talk about the 911 Commission. If you're on hold and want to talk about what we've been talking about or something new, please stay there, and we'll take your call.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Peter will be back right after this.
Take a ride in a Ford.
Yes, a very Ford dealer ride.
Take a ride.
Authorized clearance is here. It's the one sales event you don't want to miss. Now's the best time to buy a new Ford car or truck with 0% financing or cash back as high as $6,000. That's up to $6,000 cash back on Explorer 4-door, $6,000 on Freestar, up to $5,000 on Expedition and Taurus, up to $4,000 on selected Ford F-Series, and $3,000 back on Ford Focus. This is the one event you can't afford to miss. The Ford Authorized Clearance. Not all buyers will qualify for lowest APR. See dealer to see if you qualify. To be eligible for APR rate or cash incentives, you must finance through Ford Credit. Residency restrictions apply. Take new retail delivery from dealer stock by 8204. See your suburban Ford dealers for complete details. See Varsity Ford Ann Arbor, Palmer Motors, Chelsea, open Saturday. See Palmer Motors, Chelsea, Varsity Ford Ann Arbor.
Nothing can wreck an evening like getting busted for not listening. So here's a listening practice exercise from your friends at Molson. Listen very carefully.
My cousin Valerie had a baby last week. He's 7 pounds, 2 ounces, blue eyes, red hair.
I just want a guy to give me a good time all night long.
But also, she was in labor for 17 hours.
Dudes, who wants some Molson? I'm buying.
They named him Aiden.
Oh, is my bum showing again?
Okay, what was her cousin's name, baby's name, weight, sex, eye color, hair, time and labor? If you answered Valerie, Aiden, 7 pounds, 2 ounces, boy, blue, red, 17 hours, congratulations. If you didn't, keep practicing. With an easy drinking Molson, of course. Molson, making friends since 1786. Imported from Canada by Molson USA, LLC, Golden, Colorado. In 1786, John Molson began brewing beer using the finest Canadian water and barley from a land we now call Saskatchewan. We left well enough alone.
4.75%. That's the low rate American Equity Mortgage is now offering you as homeowners.
That's right, Ray. Interest rates have dropped down to the lowest they've been since the record low levels in early spring. Homeowners who miss those low rates now have a second chance. But in this economy, rates could go back up any day. So you must call American Equity Mortgage immediately.
4.75%. With a rate like that, you can save hundreds of dollars every month. Think about it. What will you do with the extra money you suddenly have when you roll your car loan and all that high interest credit card debts into one new loan with one low monthly payment?
Plus, Ray, homeowners with adjustable rate mortgages should act now to get a new ARM with a fixed low rate for another 3 years before their old ARM's rates go up.
Don't delay. 4.75%.
Call our Detroit office at 888-229-7699. 888-229-7699.
Call now for a free appraisal. Rate subject to change. APR 4.922. Rate subject to increase after confirmation.
More Night Call with Peter Worthy. Next on The Rim.
Citizens of Michigan, now that I've fixed California's problems, let me tell you something. I want to help all of the people get a new car. So if you have a job and $199, Dick Scott Kia in Canton and Dick Scott Kia of Waterford will terminate your past credit problems.
Do you have a job? Do you have $199? Then you could be approved at Dick Scott Kia in Canton and Dick Scott Kia of Waterford. Brand new Kia Rio. Start at just $7,899. That's just $7,899. Plus, every new Kia is backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. Now, you can tell your past credit problems.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Make every mile count only at Dick Scott Kia. Michigan Avenue, a quarter mile west of I-275 in Canton. And Dick Scott Kia of Waterford. At the Summit Place Mall on Elizabeth Lake Road, just west of Telegraph. Call 866-6-KIA now. That's 866-6-KIA-NOW.
Qualified buyers plus tax, title, and plate fees. All rebates to dealer.
Walt Michael Army Center, the ultimate recreational superstore.
All this month, truck and SUV owners get hooked up for free. Hi, Christine Michael here for Walt Michaels RV Superstores. Turn your truck or SUV into a condo on wheels with a travel trailer or fifth wheel, and we'll hook you up for free. Get free labor and installation on all fifth wheels and travel trailers only at Walt Michaels RV Center. That's a $1,500 value. So turn your truck or SUV into a two-bedroom condo with a 25-foot wilderness bunkhouse for as low as $219 a month. Your kids will love the bunk beds, and you'll enjoy all the extra space a super slide out gives you. Free hookup applies on all towables priced over $15,000. Payment based on 20% down, 144 months with 7.99% financing. Offer ends July 31st. Remember, no one hooks you up better than Walt Michaels RV. Call 800-697-2500. We'll be looking for you.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, more of your comments, questions, and opinions with your host, Peter Worby.
All right, thank you very much. We have our winners this hour for the DVD, Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky in the Media. Charles, I'm going to stumble on this name probably. Charles Majura and Jim Snyder. And we'll have another one to give away at half past this hour. Now, the September 11th Commission, bipartisan, five from each party, the ex-governor of New Jersey, Republican Kane, the chair. Who comes out worse? These are questions and answers in the New York Times. President Bush or President Clinton? According to the Times, neither comes off well, but if there has to be a winner, the report seems to portray Mr. Clinton as better informed and more engaged than Mr. Bush. Now, Bush, remember, was getting these memos saying Al-Qaeda going to strike in the United States, and he was just down on Crawford. So the two key elements to the Bush campaign are September 11th and Iraq. And they're both disasters, absolute disasters that he has presided over. Let's see. Clinton, as national security advisor, the report says, had, quote, a special daily pipeline of reports feeding them the latest updates on bin Laden's reported location, close quote. You know, of course, Bush and Ashcroft and all the rest of those didn't even want to hear about any of this. Report says Condoleezza Rice, Bush's national security advisor, and her deputy, Stephen Hadley, did not seem to regard the coordination of domestic agencies as part of their responsibility after they took office in 2001, even as warnings of a possible attack continued to grow. Now, who was president on September 11th? If Al Gore properly would have been seated in the White House and this atrocity would have occurred, wouldn't every one of us have said, this man is responsible, he's the boss? What happens when the person in charge drops the ball, lets our guard down, particularly in the face of all the warnings that were there? Now, let's see. Did the report find Iraq had any connection with September 11th? The commission, now listen to this, folks, because some of you are still thinking, yeah, well, Saddam tried to bomb, he bombed us on September 11th, so we had to get him. Did the report find Iraq had any connection with the September 11th attack? once and for all. The commission says it had no indication that contacts between Iraq and al-Qaeda in the 90s ever developed into a collaborative operational relationship, a conclusion different in tone from the assertions by Cheney and other Bush administration officials, because they're lying, and they know they're lying. Did the report say whether the invasion of Iraq made future terrorist attacks against the United States more or less likely? Well, almost all of us in every poll now say it makes it more likely. So Bush, first and foremost, leaves the country defenseless. So we get attacked on September 11th in the most catastrophic assault on this nation we've ever experienced. And somehow his approval ratings go up. Now we've got an idea that he was asleep at the switch, some even say purposely. All right, anyways. The report say whether we're safer. No, but the report does warn that if Iraq becomes a failed state, it will go to the top of the list of places that are breeding grounds for attacks against Americans at home. Well, it already is that. And the report seems to indirectly criticize the Bush administration for failing to match its military effort against terrorism since September 11th with an equally aggressive diplomatic campaign. And it kind of goes on in that regard. Now, there were several other things in here. Have I totally lost those? These are. Official verdict, White House misled world over Saddam. This is in the London Independent. The liberation of Iraq removed an ally of al-Qaeda. George Bush said that in May of 2003. Cheney, there's overwhelming evidence of a connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq. Rumsfeld, within a week or a month, Saddam could give his weapons of mass destruction to al-Qaeda. That's in November 2002. Saddam was a danger in the region where the 9-1-1 threat emerged, Condoleezza Rice. The Independent says the Bush administration's credibility was dealt a devastating blow yesterday when the commission investigating the attacks of September 11th said there was no credible evidence that Saddam Hussein's regime had assisted al-Qaeda, something repeatedly suggested by the president and his senior officials and held up as a reason for the invasion of Iraq. It continues. A report by the Independent Commission said that while there were contacts between Iraq and al-Qaeda operatives in the 90s, it appears Osama bin Laden's requests for a partnership were rebuffed. The commission said we have no credible evidence that Iraq and al-Qaeda cooperated on attacks against the United States. The report forced the Bush administration to the defensive. Well, it should. New York Times. It's hard to imagine how the commission investigating the 2001 terrorist attacks could have put it more clearly yesterday. There was never any evidence of a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda between Saddam Hussein and September 11th. Now President Bush should apologize to the American people who were led to believe something different. Of all the ways Mr. Bush persuaded Americans to back the invasion of Iraq last year, the most plainly dishonest was his efforts to link his war of choice with the battle against terrorists worldwide. While it's possible that Bush and his top advisors really believed there were chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons in Iraq, I don't think they thought that for a minute. They should have known all along there was no link between Iraq and al-Qaeda. No serious intelligence analyst believed the connection existed. Richard Clark, the former anti-terrorism Bush's chief, wrote in his book that Bush had been told just that. These people should be impeached. They shouldn't be defeated. The Bush regime has committed high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, here is a letter. Where is it? Someone asked, please, not just American deaths, but how many overall of coalition troops? Well, it's over 1,000, over 900 now. In fact, this is from July 21st. American soldiers in Iraq have been dying at a rate of 2 a day since Iraqis regained political control on June 28th, a drop from the deadliest months, but about the same rate overall in the last 16 months since the U.S. invasion. The U.S. military death toll has now reached 900, and the number of Americans injured is approaching 6,000. So there's almost 7,000 American casualties, all based on a Bush lie. This is a high crime. It's not even a misdemeanor. It's a high crime. Bush should be impeached along with the whole rest of these gangsters. And, you know, I was looking on my site. This is very interesting. You can go there, and I'm somewhere along the line. It talks about American dead. And I just started looking at that. I mean, this gets very political. This gets questions of statecraft and government policy. But all these people are dead. Bush lied monumentally. And tens of thousands of people have died, Iraqis and U.S. soldiers. And mostly Iraqis are faceless to Americans. But I started looking at the faces. Actually, you can go to Michael Moore's film. You can see some of the faces. But I went and I was looking down the row of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mostly young, some even Americans over 50, but mostly young Americans. And one of the things that popped out, I mean, you think about what we thought when there was about three times that. We're heading towards that on September 11th. When there hundreds of American soldiers dead for a lie. And I looked, one thing that jumped out, I'm not sure what to make of this, that almost every person, every mostly young men, a couple women in there, but all the whites were from rural towns. It was astounding. I didn't go through all 900. But it was like everyone from a small town in Michigan, a small town in Georgia, a small town in Nevada, a small town in California, were minorities, Hispanics and African Americans, often were from large cities. But all the whites from these small towns, maybe just a way to get out. These towns are dying, people flooding into the big cities. And a chance to get an education. And if need be, defend this country from its enemies. Except Bush lied. Rumsfeld lied. Condoleezza Rice lied. Powell lied. They all lied. And all these people are dead. This is an impeachable offense. Your thoughts, please. 313-298-WRIF. And calltalkyes@yahoo.com. A person asked earlier, how do I get on your mailing list? Just write to calltalkyes@yahoo.com and ask me. All right, and I have a list here, line 3. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening, Peter. I wanted to add some optimism and some paradoxical information.
Sure.
Shall I say, under the RICO Act or organized crime, a group of people selling internet kiosks, phone cards, etc., created numerous entities in Florida under the Florida Corporation Bureau's auspices. And the interesting thing, the paradox is that they got away with it for, the better part of almost 4 years.
Wait, you lost me here. What are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about that actually, here's the paradox.
Okay.
And you didn't allow me to get to it.
Sure, okay.
The paradox is that the Dallas, Texas FTC, Southwest Division, is the one who finally filed a civil suit against this organized crime group. Vis-a-vis Florida allowed them to operate, gratuitously. They allowed them to rip off everybody and their grandmother, literally. I mean, people died.
Okay. All right. And the point is, this still escapes me.
Well, the point is that at least government on some level operates conscientiously.
Oh, okay. Sure.
And that the paradox is that Florida perpetuated their crime scheme without any friction or breaks balances and measures of making sure that they weren't obstructing the law. And it turns out that the Dallas, Texas Southwest FTC division has filed suit against these people.
Well, that's good. The Federal Trade Commission, glad to see they're doing their job. I thank you for that comment. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, I would like to see if you are familiar with the article that was in Playboy this month about Detroit and the decline of Detroit.
I guess the mayor is all upset about it, right?
Yeah, well, it was kind of shocking but eye-opening to the things that you actually see living in Detroit. But the thing that I didn't quite understand was that they claimed that most of the people that live in Detroit, being minorities, are probably 47% are out of work, and probably 75% of that 47% was not actively not seeking employment and gaining money through other means such as drugs and, you know, other things. And they were, and it was really shocking that they claimed that there was, between the beginning of 2004 to the, I guess, the date the article was written, that there had been 110 violent murders, and 50% of them are unsolved and will be unsolved.
Hmm. Well, yeah, Detroit proper is in the middle of a major depression, not a recession, a major depression, and those figures of unemployment are just catastrophic for the Detroit community. I mean, I'm surprised that it holds on as well that it, as it does. And you have a glittering downtown that's getting facelift all the time and some commitment like General Motors to move its headquarters downtown, but it's not like there's concentric circles or ripples that are going out to the margins. And remember, I mean, I'm sure that there's tons of people that have thought, have totally given up looking for work. But also, if when your unemployment runs out and you're not registering with the Federal Job Service, you're considered a discouraged worker, and they don't even count you in the employment. And then that's when people do what they call innovation. They begin thinking, well, I need some money, so what is available? And since a major industry in big cities and in the suburbs is the drug trafficking, that's where people gravitate to that are energetic entrepreneurs and want to get ahead.
Well, it just seemed like the article really stressed that Detroit is, trying to think of how they exactly put it, but like Detroit was a disgrace to the country, that it was like a economic disaster.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not a disgrace. It is disgraceful that we have this level of poverty and unemployment in a country that's the wealthiest country in the world, but it has a lot to do with the distribution of income, so that this enormous amount of wealth is being produced, and it goes to the elite, mainly the middle class and the working class, the people that are involved in employment. Don't see any of that other than, I mean, in other words, the income and the share of wealth that they have doesn't increase at all. And the people that are on the margins of society actually are growing. The number of people on the margins, as we see it, where there starts to be a collapse almost of what we consider, quote, normal society. That is, people working at jobs and getting incomes and staying together in houses and families. That just begins to erode. So rather than seeing this as a national crisis, the Bush administration ensures that it's only going to get worse by taking money that could be used for any number of other purposes and at home, and gives it away to these people that destroyed Iraq and that are now rebuilding it. So there's a friend of mine who's a talk show host, Mike Malloy, and he calls Bush the Bush crime family. And it's exactly because of this, because essentially we're being looted of our productive, of the wealth that we've produced as middle class and working class people on one hand, and then it is used in a criminal manner. So I'm not at all unfriendly to talking about the Bush crime family, and if it wouldn't almost be the trademark of Mike Malloy, I would use it all the time myself. But I got to, someone else told me about this. I got to check the article out. Thank you for telling us about it. We are continuing on to line one. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Yeah, Peter. My name is Charlie. I'm from Ypsilanti.
Hi.
I'm calling in response to the party preference on voting registration.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that got abolished about 2 or 3 years ago, if I remember right. Basically, after the whole George W. Fiasco down in Florida, they just said, forget it. There were too many people trying to vote, do a split ballot, and instead of doing their primary choice, so they got rid of that preference selection.
Yeah, the primaries are even different now, aren't they?
They're supposed to be. They're supposed to be, but basically what they generally would do is they'd ask if you have a personal preference of party. When I registered to vote, I have a choice of Republican, Democrat, or Independent.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that, like I said, right up to about 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, being way independent, I usually don't get involved in party politics. So I've sort of lost track of how that all goes down. Yeah, anyways, I always thought it was weird that the state paid for these elections. In other words, they'd put out millions of dollars to select candidates for two private political parties. And not being a Democrat and not being a Republican, I'm thinking, why am I paying for the Republicans and the Democrats to choose their, you know, which of their elected, which of their candidates is going to be the candidate against the other? And I always toyed with the idea of bringing a lawsuit, but then I thought, you know, I've got other better things to do with my life. And there's lots of other ways we're getting robbed. All right, thank you for the information. I appreciate it, Charlie. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi, good evening.
Hi.
My name is Jesse. I'm calling from Windsor. I'm originally Iraqi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Bush didn't lie, to be honest with you, because that madman, you know, if he'd have got his hand off any weapon, he would have used it. And I know a lot of people died, but to understand the situation, you have to be, like, living there first and coming here, then you know what's going on. And if he had any weapons, it would have made it worse than 9/11, that guy. You know, like I said, that.
Well, there is no reason to suspect, though, that either he would give them to anyone, nor, I mean, see, this is just a litany. Look, Saddam Hussein was in there, as I'm sure being an Iraqi you know, because of the policies of the United States, of supporting him, of giving him the wherewithal to attack Iran, to create weapons of mass destruction. Those are all taken away. And for the longest time that he was, particularly after the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein was simply interested in remaining in power. He is an awful evil man. He was an awful evil man when Ronald Reagan and George Bush the first supported him, when Donald Rumsfeld went over and gave him golden spurs and shook his hand, and any Iraqi family has known somebody or directly suffered as a result of this policy. Because of that, then George Bush the first goes in there, does all this incredible destruction. I know you know all this. Encourages Shiites and Kurds to revolt, and then doesn't help them, and lets Saddam slaughter tens of thousands of more people. Then his son comes along and decides this would be great for his ratings, and plus they'd be able to control the Iraqi oil. So it's fine that Saddam Hussein is gone, but I don't think we needed this another mountain of bodies in order to to accomplish it. And besides, that's not what Bush said. Bush said he has weapons of mass destruction. He's going to use them soon. This was totally fabricated.
Yeah. But, you know, like, to be a Christian from Iraq, it's a totally different situation. You know, like, you're not free. You know, just you can't be, not just with Saddam, with the people, you know, like the people that support him. And we can't go to church. You can't do the things we're supposed to do on Christmas, you know, like, it's unbelievable. Now, my cousins, they got killed because they worked for United Nations. They just got shot last week, you know, because the culture, you know, like, you don't understand. They hate Christianity.
Right.
Basically it, you know, like, they don't like us. And no matter where we are, no matter what we do, just because we have a cross on our, you know, neck, that's it. We'll kill us. They shoot us.
But you're
I think, I'm a Christian, yes. I'm Babylonian.
Yeah.
And I'm the first. Jesus spoke our language, that's all I can tell you. So, you know, like Aramaic, that's the language we speak, you know.
Well, you know, when somebody makes a bad mistake, you can't always fix it overnight. And the United States made an awful mistake by supporting Saddam Hussein in the 1970s and 1980s. And the United States has compounded it ever since then by making things worse and worse and worse. And things are not getting better in Iraq. Things are getting worse. And the kind of tragedy that you're discussing is continuing.
The only thing I can tell you, George Bush, the father, he thought that Saddam Hussein, 1962-63, in Egypt, how to speak English and how to do politics, stuff like that. That's, you know, we know that for a fact. And they're buddies, you know, like they're good friends. And now they're worst enemies because this time is up. That's it, you know. And but they don't have to kill all these. I feel very bad to see all these soldiers go from here, risk, you know, like killing. I don't know what to say. You know, like killing, killing themselves for us. You know what I mean? Like we're Iraqi people to be free, and these people don't understand. They don't want it. You know.
Well, I know. I mean, there was certainly what's happening, and is that who could very easily come to power are exactly the kind of intolerant people that you mentioned, that that aren't respectful of other people's religion.
That's a religion, you know, like they hate Christianity, and I've been here 22 years, you know, and I went back 3-4 times. They're still the same people. They never change. You know, my way you do to them, they will never, ever change these guys, you know.
Well, I'm sorry that such a tragedy is happening to your country, and hopefully one day it'll all be made right. Thank
I
you,
hope,
sir.
So. I hope. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for making our program international. There was this AP article about how Bush had a big edge in the Electoral College, and Dave from Ypsilanti writes in, here's the real info on the Electoral College. You want to go to electoralvote.com. It's electoral-vote.com, electoral-vote.com. And as we go there, let's see, this one shows Kerry with three, the Electoral Vote Predictor. It says Kerry 310 votes, Bush 217. All righty, let's continue on. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hey, my name's Chris, I'm from Sumter. Called to say that I kind of agree with what you're saying about Bush, but I think what we're doing over there right now is we just stirred up a hornet's nest that we can't control anymore. And like you said, people over there are just dying every day for, it seems like, no reason now.
Imagine some of these troops would have extended tours, or now they're calling up, the ready reserves, people that thought that they'd served all their time. And in the meantime, you know, we're told that we're no safer now than we were. In fact, we might be more at risk. Isn't that
right.
Sharp?
Yeah. And there was a movie one time that the guy said that if they wanted to kill their kids, the parents ought to just shoot them at home, you know?
Hey, there's a new movie coming out, a remake of Manchurian Candidate with Denzel Washington and Meryl Streep that I think ought to be pretty interesting. My wife and I just watched the original Manchurian Candidate with Frank Sinatra and who else? Janet Leigh and some other people. And extraordinary movie, and this remake really looks good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really think what's going on in Iraq right now is just, I don't know, I don't see an end to it.
Well, it could be not much of an end. They're talking about 130,000 troops there for years, and that's where our money goes. I'm just friends with a lot of teachers, and all of them are just telling me how there's more and more layoffs, and we've got X amount of money, and we can either hire teachers for our kids in the Detroit area, suburbs and the city, or we can give it to Bush's buddies in Halliburton and Bechtel and places like that. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And in about 10 minutes or so, we'll be giving away our last copy of Manufacturing Consent, a DVD about Noam Chomsky and the media. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
This is Kevin from Romulus, and I came across something. I'm not sure if you already mentioned it on your show or not, but I just thought I'd give you a heads up on this.
Sure.
There's a House committee hearing. Ranking Democrat was Henry Waxman from California, and they're doing an investigation into Halliburton and all the price fixing and overcharging us taxpayers. And they had a pretty cool snapshot of what they're charging us. I guess for our guys out there to drink a Coke, it's $50 a Coke, and a bag of laundry is $100, and the Halliburton employees are staying, living it up at some five-star hotel in safety in Kuwait City for $10,000 a night. I presume it's more than one room, hopefully.
You know, and, let me just interrupt you. I know we're getting ripped by Halliburton and these other companies, but on the face of it, that sounds exaggerated. Well, now, what this is Henry Waxman's committee? It's that bad?
Yeah, and they're talking about how our GIs are put in air-conditioned tents in the desert for $500 a night, and the Halliburton employees are supposed to be servicing the contract, or whatever fancy word you want to use, are running up a tab of $10,000 a night. So, I mean, it's just so out of whack. And, I mean, it could... I mean, this is something I hear in mainstream news. This is not conspiracy nonsense. This is not something that, you know, somebody cooked up in their basement. This is serious stuff that I guess a bunch of ex-employees who used to work for that concern came out to the committee and basically said that they didn't operate with any concept of, like, controlling costs, because they said, we don't care because the taxpayers are going to pick it up.
Sure. Well, you just realize what some of these guys are making. Truck drivers, 100, is it a... I don't know. I actually don't have the figures in front of me. I don't want to say. But the government now is this huge cash cow. The only unfortunate thing is that we're paying the freight. All right, I'm going to check that out, or maybe someone else can do that as well. Thank you so much. If you or anyone else has a link, send it to me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Brian writes in, and also if you want to be on the mailing list, send to there as well. It says, hello, Peter. Friends that attend school in Marquette and are there during the summer. With Bushko's recent visit, they got tickets and made anti-Bush signs and wore Kerry Edwards shirts and were denied entrance to the rally. I informed them to contact you and other rational talk show hosts, Al Franken and Michael Moore, and tell their story. I mean, this is typical, Brian, that... free speech is increasingly getting to be a thing of the past, particularly under the guise of security. Anti-war protesters, Kerry demonstrators, are not going to hurt the President of the United States. And certainly having a demonstration out in front of a place where he's speaking or going inside is not going to harm the president. You know, I was listening to some old tapes of Harry S. Truman, who was president when? From 1945 to 52. And he was giving a campaign speech. And you could hear about three-quarters of the people applauding and about a quarter of the people booing. So, I mean, Republicans came there, and Harry was giving the Republicans hell. Remember, Harry Truman was give them hell? And he said famously one time, I don't give them hell, I just tell the truth, and they think it's hell. And that's why Republicans and conservatives try to suppress speech, because if the truth gets out, you know, they're finished. They just have to live this, you know, these lies out. That's why they hate Michael Moore's film so much. By the way, Tanya from Detroit, thank you, Tanya, sent me a correction to Michael Moore. There's actually a glaring error. I mean, I hate to do this to you folks, but we got to be honest. This may turn you completely around. Remember in the section where they show Bush after he gets the word that the United States, or that the second tower has been hit, and for 7 minutes he sits there like a deer in the headlights, looking like, what the hell am I going to do? Someone's got to tell me what to do. The story, let me see here. In Fahrenheit 9-1-1, Moore says that the book is called My Pet Goat. Right, Dan? It's called My Pet Goat. This is a glaring error on Michael Moore's part and may just result in the tumbling down of his credibility. It's not My Pet Goat, it's The Pet Goat. Michael Moore, you should be ashamed. You got to get your facts right. All right. Thanks for that. We're going to line one, is it? Yeah. All right. I said it, we'll do it. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter, it's Jimmy Vanicom from St. Clair Shores.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. A couple quick questions. The federal government, is it true I heard they collect almost $2 trillion in taxes a year, approximately?
That's interesting. I don't know what the revenue... No, I don't think they collect $2 trillion, do they? Maybe they do.
Well, the national debt, is it true it's like $6 trillion?
Yeah, that is true.
That belongs to the World Banks. We owe that to the World Banks, correct?
We owe it to bankers, loan institutions, some domestic, a lot of it foreign. Yeah, we're paying, when we pay our taxes now, because Bush has driven us into debt, part of our tax money goes for interest, just like when we pay our credit cards if we haven't paid them off.
Well, yeah, people forget. Didn't Ronald Reagan leave when he boosted the military? Didn't he leave a deficit?
Yeah, he did too. There's a pattern here. You're onto it.
Right.
Yeah.
And one other thing, Pete, is I don't have personal access to the internet, and I work afternoons.
Uh-huh.
So I don't get to see 2020 or 60 Minutes or any of those programs. But I wonder, like, you know, where's the voice, you know, like the opinions of the soldiers that are, you know, still alive in Iraq, or the families of the deceased soldiers, you know, and how they feel about the occupation in Iraq? And
well, I just, I should have saved that. I don't know why I didn't bring it. I mean, soldiers there, as you can imagine, their main thing is to come home alive and not have be one of the, or not be one of the 6,000 American soldiers that have had limbs broken off or blown off and what have you. One of the most, I mean, it's sort of equal between the Iraqis that appear in Michael Moore's films and the American soldiers, some of them where he's interviewing them in hospitals. That's what we don't see. Those are the soldiers that have, some who have paid the ultimate price for Bush's, some say mistakes, I say lies. Others are going to live with the results of it for all their lives. Jimmy, thanks a lot. I got to go. I got to take a break. We'll be right back. And, hey, the next person that calls in that wants this DVD, Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky in the Media, you got it. 313-298-WRIF.
WRIF.com. Getting ready to move into your new home? Got a business to relocate? Need help moving and packing delicate or fragile stuff? For your moving needs, don't bother calling the middleman when you can go straight to the boss. The professionals at Boss Moving and Service. Boss Moving and Service has been family owned and operated for over 20 years. They specialize in local moving with a fleet of 9 trucks. They carry a full line of packing materials. They're licensed by the state and fully insured. Boss is also your home and business relocation specialist. Whether it's one item, a piano, or organ, maybe a delicate antique or an entire truckload. Whatever you need to make your move go smoother, Boss Moving and Service has you covered. Compare Boss Moving's low prices to the other guys, and you'll learn what others in Metro Detroit have known for years. Don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss. Call the professionals at Boss Moving and Service toll-free at 800-706-6644. Call today for a free in-home estimate at 800-706-6644. Remember, don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss.
Hey, it's Mike Walters from The Morning Show, and I'm as excited as you are that summer is officially here. Summer, of course, means hot weather, but extreme temperatures can really affect your car's transmission, and you certainly don't need a breakdown in the middle of a summer road trip or when you're rolling around town with your buds. So if you're hearing any grinding, feeling slipping, seeing fluid, or think you might have a transmission problem, visit one of AAMCO's 4 locations in the Detroit area. Call 1-800-GO-AAMCO, that's A-A-M-C-O, for the center nearest you. Tell them I sent you for a free diagnostic check at participating centers. Just call for an appointment. AAMCO technicians are the best in the field. They're trained and certified in advanced transmission diagnosis, repair, and maintenance. So taking your car to AAMCO is like having vacation insurance. And with the skyrocketing gas prices, a better running car means better gas mileage. For a job done right, guaranteed, at a price that's right, AAMCO. AAMCO.
This is WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
What the hell does Detroit want with Arkansas?
Well, you know, just same old thing. Just shoot the breeze, you know.
Damn, I ain't got time to mess you damn people up there. I got work to do here, and you keep calling, 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 raising hell with me. What's the matter?
You become an important part of the program, Delbert. It's actually, it should be a compliment.
Yeah.
What the hell does Michigan want with Arkansas?
I guess this is the first time we've run into you in a bad mood.
Well, you know, I guess everybody gets that once in a while after so much irritation.
Yeah.
Did something happen the last time we talked?
No, I don't reckon. This is the way it has to be, I guess. Let me tell you one thing before you hang up.
All right.
All right.
This is an April Fool's joke on you bastards.
You crotchety old curmudgeon.
I always knew you were... But man, oh man.
Drew and Mike in the Morning. Broadcast program.
on the Riff.
101.1 WRIF.
All day Thursday, your walk right in free station. 101 The Riff unleashes a ticket blitz Thursday. Keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF all day this Thursday
for your chance to hook up with tickets to all of the hottest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Hooking you up like no other Detroit station can.
Listen for your chance to win.
Then call the Riff request line at 313-298-WRIF.
Don't forget.
You can always improve your chances to win by joining the Riff Cyber Crew today and score your totally unfair internet advantage.
Just log on to WRIF.com.
It's Ticket Blitz Thursday on the Riff. All day Thursday from your walk right in free station. 101 The Riff.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
Bill Clinton proving one more time he'll talk to anybody for a crumb of attention as he talked to us again.
What about Jennifer Flowers? I mean, do you regret lying about her on 60 Minutes?
No, I don't. I don't think so. No.
Well, why not?
Because I wanted to get elected, and I just felt like if the nation's first big exposure to me was hearing about me spanking a big strange ass, yanking on a handful of her blonde hair.
Station and Pick It Up, I think, are either Dan or Jay told you that. And a couple of people didn't pick up their passes for the showing of the corporation at the main theater in Royal Oak, T-shirt and a book that the film is based on. So we're going to give you till next week, and if you don't get it, we're going to give it away to somebody else. All right? Anyways, 1 a.m. we'll be doing interviews, and there's an interview. This, you know, you should always be very positive. There's an interview that I'm going to play. It's called, it's by Eric Zeus, and it's called, you know, I don't have it in front of me. I just have Iraq here. But it's Iraq War, The Truth, I think, or something like that. And it's pretty good. It's not the greatest one I ever did until the end. And then all of a sudden, he comes out with this information that's truly startling. And then, again, this doesn't sound like it's going to be real exciting, but it's an author talking about Pullman porters. These are the African-American men that worked on these sleeping cars between, like, the end of the Civil War and, I think, 1968. And the role they played in everything from civil rights to jazz, I think, is fairly compelling. Now, Mike writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I was telling the audience about I'd gone down to this anti-Bush demonstration on Friday when he was in town talking to the Urban League, and there was this pro-Bush march, and I thought that they were mostly been mobilized by one fundamentalist church. They were very anti-abortion, and they all seemed to know one another. Anyway, one woman had a red flag, and I was teasing her, asking her, why did she have a communist flag? I actually had no idea why she had this red flag. And suddenly, and very menacingly, she screamed at me that it was, and I can't even imitate it, or my voice will go completely, that it was the blood of Christ. I went, whoa, man, these people are got a thing on blood. Mike says, about the red flag incident, it makes me want to laugh and shake my head in disgust at the same time. The religiosity, he says, in this country is mind-blowing. We rival the Middle East when it comes to the volume of religious extremists that live here. That's very true. It seems ironic to me that the U.S., the most rich and powerful nation on earth, is steeped in Christian faith like some third-world country. The rest of the developed world is in a post-Christian era, while our citizens reject reason in favor of faith. One more thing, he says. I'm in a band called Arete. Right. I guess that's how you say it, Arete. It's A-R-E-T-E. It's the ancient Greek word for virtue. And we are playing the Detroit Rock City Bands Against Bush show on September 4th. The website says you are supposed to be speaking. All right. Yeah, that's true. Jeff was going to call in tonight, in fact. So if you go to my website, he says, how about advertising it on the air? There's also a show this Saturday. I think it's the 31st. At any rate, hope to see you there. Keep up the good work. Well, I'm going to be there as particularly on September 4th if I'm speaking. But I'd like to get some folks out there. Go to my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and then go down the left side, and it says Detroit Calendar. Click on that, and you'll see a link to the website. Okay, continuing on. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Are you with me? Well, that was not a hell of a... I'll give him one more chance. Are you there? Nope, that was it. All right. Our next call, Dan, that was a short one. Somebody just wanted to know how I was doing, and I'm doing fine. Hi, WRIF, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Pete.
Hi.
You know, I was listening about the video games earlier. You know, and it seems like we're in such a disposable economy nowadays. Both parents have to work because the economy is a shot. Everybody wants all this instant gratification, and everybody wants to blame all their problems on everything else.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's like with this video game thing here. You got everyone saying the video games are the fall of America. How about some of these parents that are complaining about the games and everything? How about they actually try parenting? You know, you see a lot of them out here screaming about how good of parents they are, but they're gone most of the time.
Well, part of it, though, I mean, you sound like a little bit critical in that, but what you just said, that it's not like it used to be. People have to be working. And also, I think there is, I mean, we've become so overwhelmed with media that it's almost taken for granted that we're going to be immersed in some medium almost continually, whether it's the internet or television or video games. So we're spending our whole lives in front of screens.
Yeah, you know, I'm a police officer, and you know, it's amazing how you see these children that are basically raising themselves nowadays.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, it's a shame. You know, my wife and I, we both have to work, and fortunately, we've been able to schedule it so that when I'm working, she's at home with the children, and when she's working, I'm home. But a lot of people can't do that nowadays. You know, it's a real shame that the people who run this country have allowed it to get to the point where we're dumping so much money and worrying about all these other, well, in Bush's case, about his own pocketbook and Cheney's. You know, they're dumping all that money into all these other unnecessary things, and here we have children in this country who are raising themselves.
Yeah, and I, you know, who knows what the result of it's going to be when these children come of age.
Most certainly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I think it's an important concern.
Real quick, how do I get a copy of that DVD you were talking about?
Oh, I mean, since you didn't win it, I wonder if there's a website here. I'm going to, man, I need, you know, some of this stuff on the back of DVDs you need a magnifying glass for.
Well, I was calling in, and I kept getting the busy signal, and when I finally did call in, you had given them all away, and then, you know, then after I get called in and get online, you gave another one away. So I figured I'd go ahead and buy one.
Well, I think you could probably go to Amazon.com. The man's name is Chomsky, Chomsky.
Okay.
And there are so many sites available that with his stuff on it. That
now, what is the actual name of the DVD?
Manufacturing Consent. It's about how the media functions.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling.
I was a stone-cold Republic until I started listening to your show.
Uh-oh.
And learned the truth.
All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. And I don't think it was just me. I think he's being nice. Steve in Dearborn Heights wrote in, I forgot about this, to remind me that Linda Ronstadt was removed from a Las Vegas casino after she dedicated a song to Michael Moore. In fact, on my website, it says, "We love Linda Ronstadt." You know how many... You know, I mean, I know Linda Ronstadt exists, and she's got a few classic rock songs that are pretty decent. But do you know how many, Dan, I'll ask you this. Do you know how many albums Linda Ronstadt has sold? 50 million. I mean, that's up there like with Beatles and Journey and these, I mean... Man, think about it. If she got a buck an album, probably more. Anyways, so I knew that she'd been booted out. It was absolutely disgraceful. They took her right from hotel security because of the owner, Bill Timmons, who's a Republican. Took when she announced this, and you probably saw this in this casino. She dedicated her last song, "Desperado," the old Eagles song. She was escorted right to her tour bus. They wouldn't even let her go to her room. Now this is from CBS News. Imagine Fahrenheit 9/11 filmmaker Michael Moore and singer Linda Ronstadt on stage in Las Vegas singing America the Beautiful at the very same casino resort where she was, some people booed her and told her not to come. Well, she was booed. A few people booed her. And she was told not to come back because of remarks praising Moore. It could happen as early as September. That's when the Aladdin is expected to change hands to a new consortium of owners, including Planet Hollywood CEO Robert Earl. He says he'll invite both Moore and Ronstadt to appear at the hotel, which is to be renamed Planet blah, blah, blah. He says, Earl says, we respect artists' creativity and support their rights to express themselves. We're very sorry to hear about the unfortunate circumstances of this past Saturday night. We want to make it clear that Planet Hollywood has never in our 13-year history restricted any artist's right to free speech, and we'll continue with that policy once we take ownership. Current Aladdin Bill Timmons, current Aladdin president Bill Timmons had Ronstadt escorted off the property after her concert because she called Michael Moore a great American patriot and dedicated the song Desperado to the outspoken filmmaker. I guess there wouldn't even be an issue if the press would have done its job and if the Democratic Party would be a little more forthright in its condemnation of Bush policies. Then it wouldn't be turned over to Michael Moore or to me or to anyone else. It's the job of an opposition party to be an opposition. We don't have an opposition party. We have another party. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Oh, Pete, this is Eric. I won that thing about the media. It sounded pretty interesting. I noticed that you can't really get straight facts. You got papers like the Detroit News just loaded with BS. And I was wondering, you think there's any papers out there that are just pretty much straight up with you? Or
daily papers?
Yeah.
No, I think I read the New York Times every day, but then there is so much BS in that. But I think you can read it online. Go to nytimes.com. Do you have the internet?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I look at that. I mean, if you go to my website, there are some good sites. In fact, it's getting easier other than some weekly papers like The Nation or monthly magazines like The Progressive or In These Times. If you go to my website, my last name is spelled W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, and on the right, there's a list of websites that I use all the time. Buzzflash.com, commondreams.org, truthout.org, counterpunch.org, and you can go from there.
Yeah. Hey, do you think for this, in August 3rd, the primaries coming up, do you think some of these liberal gun banning, gay marriage, abortion type people got to get out of there, or... You support the people in there.
No. Let's keep those people in there. Get more of them in there. All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Hey, last week we were talking about, I forgot all about this email I got. We were talking about this anti-Foxhole news. You know, Fox News has this this Robert Greenwald documentary called Outfoxed. Yeah, I've sent away for one. They still haven't sent it to me. Anyway, so we were bashing Fox News, calling it, as I've always called it, Foxhole News. Of course, they're not really in the foxhole. And Rob Walchek, who is the guy that does the Fox 2 News Hall of Shame. He's the reporter here in Detroit, and he says, I am not a fan of George W. Bush or the war in Iraq. I listened to your show last Sunday night regarding the anti-Fox News viewing party. These were thousands of people got together in homes all over America and watched this. They had parties with people and watched the video. I understand how many of your listeners are not happy with the Fox News channel. I do hope your listeners know that there's a big distinction between the Fox News Channel and those of us who work for the Fox Network. Both are owned by the News Corp. Fox Television is a broadcasting network governed by the FCC. Fox News Channel is a cable station and can do or say whatever they like without the restrictions of those of us who use the broadcast airways. I'm sure you know this stuff, but I think some of your listeners got caught up in the anti-Fox stuff, and I sure don't want to be painted under the same umbrella as those who program the right-leaning stuff on the Fox News. Here at Fox 2, says Rob Walchek, we don't take orders, direction, or have anything to do with the Fox News Channel. And we don't have any agenda to promote any presidential candidate. And if we did, I certainly wouldn't be for Bush. Kind of goes on some with that. Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I appreciate that. And on the other hand, any mainstream reporter knows that there is just a limit that they cannot go beyond, and that they have to report the news in a particular manner. And I think that overwhelmingly reporters are liberal. For one thing, they're right there and they see the truth. But they write in a way that's going to get by their editors, and the editors edit them in that way. The editors edit stories in a particular way to satisfy their corporate bosses and their stockholders, which are generally Republican and conservative. So I, you know, with all due respect, Robin, I've seen a couple of your features, which are good. In the main, it's just more, you know, Fox 2 News, like all the rest of them, are just who got shot in Detroit, who got shot in the suburbs, this fire there, and the substantive news just never makes it. I don't think so. And I'm sorry. Maybe we can talk about that. Maybe we can have lunch or something. You told me to get a hold of you. We can maybe do that. All right. I don't know if you're still listening. Let's continue on with what may be our last caller. Yeah. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, my name is Jim from Detroit.
Hi, Jim.
One of the things I want to comment on was of many things that I don't think Bush was prepared for when he started his whole war on terrorism was the longevity of it. I'm not sure if he quite realizes or is really prepared for how long a lot of these people in the Middle East can sustain a war for. I mean, they fought for hundreds and hundreds of years for some of the things that they believe in. And this is something he's going to be passing on to other presidents, whether he realizes it or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because obviously he's stationing people there for a longer amount of time, but I really don't think that he's too often prepared or really realizes how long that and how determined they are, and you know how long they can hold a fight out for.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jim. And so it's going to be like a poison pill for the Kerry administration, because he'll be damned if he stays in. He'll say, you know, you're just like Bush. And if he pulls out, Iraq will just go to hell. It's much like his dad did to Clinton with Somalia. Right before Clinton took over, the senior Bush stupidly invaded Somalia and then left Clinton with the mess.
Maybe it runs in the family.
Right. Thank you so much. Appreciate you being our final caller. All right, we've got some great interviews coming up for you, and they'll be on the air after these.
Good morning. This is Ray Vinson of American Equity Mortgage. If you're hearing our message at this time, it's probably because you're at work, driving around, or can't sleep. If you can't sleep, I hope it's not because of money problems, but if it is a money problem, American Equity Mortgage can help. You're not alone. The average household has a credit card debt of $6,000 or more and paying a fortune in interest. You see, if you're a homeowner, you can use the equity in your home to consolidate all your bills and have only one payment. Think about that, just one new low monthly payment. Your equity can be used to pay off your auto loans, credit cards, and get a new low fixed rate on your mortgage. You will be saving hundreds of dollars each month. American Equity Mortgage specializes in homeowners with less than perfect credit. We have helped thousands of people just like you get back on track. You can call our office right now, and a loan specialist will call you first thing in the morning. That's American Equity Mortgage. Call toll-free 888-71-LOAN-1, 888-71-LOAN, then the number one.
It's party time. Get a real feel of erotic image featuring Michigan's hottest male and female strippers.
Erotic image. Take a stripper to any party and watch your party come alive.
Erotic Image delivers the sexiest and most seductive entertainers right to your doorstep or wherever the party's at.
For your next bachelor, bachelorette, birthday, or any party occasion, give the gift that unwraps itself. Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, the name that says it all. Sexy, provocative, outrageous, but all in good fun.
Erotic Image, 888-41-STRIP. Strip.
Surf Erotic Image at eroticimage.com, the official home of Brutal Betty, the Erotic Image Dream Girls, the incredible hunks of Men in Motion, and those naughty awesome twosomes, the wild girly girls. Due to popular demand, Erotic Image has hosts and hostesses to kick off your party. Try one.
Go online and explore the Erotic
Erotic Image Cyber Showcase. View the dancers, check their prices, and place your order online.
Erotic Image, where image is expertise, and the experience is always erotic.
Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP. That's 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, where image is everything.
Oh, man, summer's here, and I'm still stuck in a dead-end job. Hey, this is Screaming Scott from the Riff, and I was once in that same situation till I picked up the phone and called Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield. This year, instead of a summer job, how about a new career? A job you like. In fact, last summer, I went to more concerts than I can remember. I drove a dragster. I went to golf outings and more. And the best part about it, I got paid to do it. Hey, working at WRF is a dream come true, and I'm not the only one. You'd be amazed at how many Riff air staffers got their start at Specs, including interns working alongside me are currently working and having fun and enrolled at Specs Howard now. And it's not too late for you. There's no such thing as waiting till fall to get with the program at Specs Howard School. Summer classes are still forming now, so hurry in. Check out and take the no-hassle commitment-free tour. Call 248-358-9000. Deadline is July 31st. That's 248-358-9000. Or on the web at www.specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield. It's where you start. It's where I started.
And when I walked into Jared, I felt immediately comfortable and at home.
Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry customer, Ryan Moorman.
That's Jared!
Because buying a diamond engagement ring is probably the most intimidating moment of my life to this point so far. And they've made that the easiest process it could have possibly been.
At Jared, we'll make sure you get the perfect ring, because Jared has five times the selection of ordinary jewelry stores.
When I went into a lot of the different jewelers, the selection seemed to be 2 to 3 diamonds in the carat weight that I wanted, and maybe one of those fell into the cut color or clarity that I was looking for. Jared had at least 10.
In addition to engagement rings, Jared has a fabulous selection of other beautiful diamond rings, like our 3-stone diamond ring or anniversary band, priced from $549 to $9,000.
It can only be Jared.
Jared, on Baldwin Road in Auburn Hills, across from 12 Oaks in Novi, in Utica at M59 in the Van Dyke Expressway, and our newest store across from Oakland Mall in Troy.
Attention car buyers, July is inventory reduction month at Parkway Chrysler Jeep. They have 1,000 vehicle inventory and only have room for 400. So 600 gotta go. So here's how they're gonna do it. Town and Country Stow and Go minivans for $189 a month. Jeep Liberty 4x4s, $109 a month. Grand Cherokee 4x4s, just $169 a month. And Sebring sedans for just $96 a month. Parkway has rebates up to $7,000. Employee pricing for everyone. Lease loyalty. And Parkway will get you out of your old lease and into a new one for free. Parkway will give you an additional $2,500 for your trade-in. That's right, the appraised value plus $2,500. Plus, no offer will be refused, so do not wait to take advantage of the great selection of new cars for under $200 a month. Parkway has to sell 600 cars, so they will beat any deal. This sale ends on July 30th, so hurry up to Parkway Chrysler Jeep on Gratiot at 16 and a half mile in Clinton Township, where you just show up, sign up, and ride.
Check your local paper for details.
Yeah, you're listening to WRIF Detroit. This is Night Call, and here's an interview I did earlier in the week.
Thank you very much for joining me. Hey, I bet in the last year, year and a half, we have done how many shows on the Iraq War, every aspect of it? And you could almost get to the point where, is there more to say? I've certainly said my piece. All the distinguished authors that I've had on have said theirs. So when I see a book that I think, well, the author is going to tell us something different, I hope you'll understand that we're in for something different. Most of us by now have learned that you can't depend on what we're getting in the mainstream media, certainly not from the conservative media. So here's a book that's just come my way. It's called Iraq War, The Truth. The author is Eric Zeus. It's published by Delphic Press, and Eric Zeus is the winner of America's Mencken Award for Investigative Reporting, and he's done any number of books over the years. He's appeared on like ABC TV's Nightline, on CNN's The Larry King Show, and it's a pleasure to welcome Eric Zeus to the Peter Werbe Show. Eric, thanks for joining me.
Very good. I really appreciate the opportunity, Peter.
Well, in fact, maybe we could even start with that. I mean, when you said you welcome the opportunity, your book mysteriously hasn't been getting much attention.
Yes. Unfortunately, I think that the fact that Chapter 4 is titled America's Corrupt Media, which goes into detail about the extent to which the American major media, particularly, but pretty extensively throughout the media, basically trumpeted the White House PR line that weapons of mass destruction existed, and broadcast that to the American people uncritically, and failing to do their job as investigative journalists to verify allegations before presenting them to the public as being news. I think that the fact that Chapter 4 is called America's Corrupt Media and explains the role and the responsibility and really the guilt that the media have in the United States having invaded Iraq did not go down well. It really is the most severe indictment of the American press and of their role in this that has appeared, and evidently they did not like it.
Well, you've gotten some nice endorsements all the same. Sometimes books take a while before they really take off. Well, now, there has been critiques of the media, and certainly we've done some on this show, and there's been enough critics of the way the media just sort of rolled over for the Bush machine. Another section of your book you refer to as The Smoking Gun, where it says that that it wasn't that Bush made an error, or wasn't that he received faulty information and mistakenly repeated the mistakes of what he'd been given, but he intentionally lied to the American people, as did the rest of the people in his administration. And I'd like to go back to that. I mean, I think it's interesting that you actually cite here. You can go to this section, and there is the direct truth of the lie.
Yes, actually, this is connected to America's Corrupt Media and the explanation of the role that the media played, because they continue to play this role. You see them backing and filling now, recognizing that these weapons of mass destruction, which caused all this hoopla and stirred the American people to cheer on an invasion of a country that actually posed us no threat, you see this media involvement continuing in the form of their saying now that Bush was misled by bad intelligence. We hear this now all throughout the media. And in a sense, they're covering for themselves and for their own guilt and involvement in this, because it's actually not the case that George Bush was duped by the media.
Or by the intelligence.
I mean, pardon me, by bad intelligence.
Yeah.
I mean, a guy like George Tenet is not duping the president. He is not in control of the levers of power. The United States government, the president of the United States, is his boss.
Mm-hmm.
And George Tenet was giving the president what the president was craving, was demanding, was insisting upon. The president doesn't have to turn the screws on the head of the Central Intelligence Agency in order to let the head of the CIA in on what the president wants. And what I show in the first part of the book, in particular the chapter titled Bush's Lies, is that Bush was knowingly lying about the evidence that he possessed concerning Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. This is what the media right now are trying to cover up.
So this is a double complicity, then, actually.
Absolutely.
Eric Zeus, let me ask you a question. I mean, one of the things I always say to my listeners, I'm not a particularly bright guy. I always say I work hard, and that may make up for any failings of basic intelligence. But if one took the time, beginning in August 2002, I guess it was, when suddenly, out of nowhere, at a point when the 2002 elections were about to occur and Bush's fortunes were beginning to plummet again as they had before September 11th, suddenly they discovered this incredible threat to the nation, to the region, even to the world, Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. Well, I thought, boy, that sounds nuts. And so I began following what were the contentions and what were the refutations, and I knew pretty quickly that there were no weapons of mass destruction, that there even couldn't be any weapons of mass destruction.
And in fact, the UN inspectors were reporting that.
Right.
And so it was actually on the record. And what I call in my book the smoking gun, which is an instance in which Bush was knowingly lying about the evidence and incontrovertibly was lying, was not deceived by by bad intelligence from the CIA, but was simply baldly lying. The incident there occurred, in fact, on September 7th of 2002. It was a joint press conference in which President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair faced the American press, and the world press, actually, at Camp David, after they had met privately at Camp David, and had come to the conclusion that the two countries were definitely going to invade Iraq, come what may, and irrespective of whether or not the United Nations weapons inspectors would be let back into Iraq in order to complete their weapons inspections. What George Bush said on that occasion is he said that a new report had just been issued by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is a UN agency, and that this new report said that Saddam Hussein was within 6 months of having a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm. And that scared the hell out of us.
Well, it did. In fact, it was such a shocking statement that a few reporters that evening asked the White House press office in Washington, can you please tell us what report this was from the IAEA? Because we don't know of its existence. And what happened thereafter is, as I detail in my book, basically a peeling away back from one layer to the next of one lie after another as to what IAEA report this referred to. The White House quickly had to acknowledge that there was no new report from the IAEA on Iraqi nuclear arms, whatsoever.
In any European country, probably would have caused a lie of that magnitude, probably would have caused the government to fall, but there was barely a ripple.
That's true. The extent to which the American media let this drop is really rather shocking in itself. You see, what had happened here is that the President of the United States concocted a report that did not exist. He attributed it to a United Nations agency, the International Atomic Energy Agency. Actually, that agency then issued a press release saying, we've issued no new report. And in fact, in order for us to make a statement about the current condition of the Iraqi nuclear program, if it exists at all, we have to go back in and the inspections have to be resumed. The White House ignored that. The press ignored that. There was no publicizing in the press that even the IAEA said essentially that the president had lied.
Mm-hmm.
The fascinating thing here is that the last IAEA report concerning the Iraqi nuclear program was actually their 1999 report, which was the report that they prepared after they left Iraq in December of 1998. And in that report, they said that the Iraqi nuclear program had been totally removed, that there was nothing left.
Yeah, that if you really follow it all, and it was difficult for most Americans think their politicians aren't going to lie. I don't know why they think that, but most Americans trust a man up there in a suit with a little American flag pin on their lapel. They tend to believe, for another reason I don't understand, mostly stuff that's coming across the corporate and the conservative media, and you'd think people had learned by now. Hey, I'm Peter Werby, and I am interviewing Eric Zeus. He is the author of Iraq War, The Truth. And it's published by Delphic. Like I say, I don't know when are people going to learn. One of the things, though, that I think is unique about your book, there's a number of things. The fact that what you said about that here is incontrovertible proof that this wasn't mistaken intelligence, but actually concocted stories, what is generally called lies. And yet there's another aspect to this book that I'm not really sure how to take. I mean, I think there's aspects of it, but that's what you talk about regarding the role played by the Christian right. Now, we certainly know that they're big cheerleaders for war, that the neocons, many of them who are Jewish Americans, Wolfowitz and Pearl and I don't know, I can't tell who's a particular religion unless they identify themselves, that you...
Well, actually, Dick Cheney is a neoconservative, and so too...
Well, not Jewish, though.
Well, no, but the identification of the neoconservatives with Jews is, I think...
I see what you're saying. Mistake.
Something is somewhat overblown. Wait a minute, let me
just make a point here. I mean, people have brought that up to me sometimes on my shows and said, oh, this proves blah, blah, blah about Jews. And I go, wait a minute, man, you are way barking up the wrong, the wrong tree if you start trying to invoke ethnicity. I mean, that people do have particular agendas, but the only reason that the Jewish neocons got a hearing is because they supported the Bush agenda. Also, there's probably enough people of enough Jewish citizens on the anti-war side to make it a complete irrelevancy in terms of what their religion is, right?
Well, in any event,
yeah.
I think that it really is important to understand the role that straight, flat-out evangelical and fundamentalist Christian organizations played in having brought this invasion about.
Okay, sure.
In the fifth chapter of the book, I deal with the fifth chapter is titled Bush's Motive for the Crime. And in that chapter, I describe in some detail the extent to which this, well, I've already laid out that this was Bush's war. This was not just Vice President Cheney's war. It was not just Condoleezza Rice's war. It was not just a Powell's war. It was above all the war of the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Sure.
And that the reason for this war was actually indicated in a speech that George Bush gave to the Council for National Policy on October 9th of 1999. This was a speech that he gave to a group which refuses to make its membership list public, but some lists have leaked out. And what they are is an organization of, for the most part, aristocratic, some very aristocratic and extremely wealthy billionaire fundamentalist Christian families.
Hmm.
And other fundamentalist Christians who are involved in politics, including many senators, Republican senators, and congressmen, and some governors and former governors, all Republicans.
And what's the name of this group?
It's called the Council for National Policy.
Okay.
It was established in 1981 by Tim LaHaye, who had previously been a co-founder of the Moral Majority, and who is now a best-selling novelist.
I was going to say, the Left Behind series.
Yes, right.
That all of the people that don't accept Jesus on their terms,
right.
You can even accept Jesus, but you got to accept it on their terms, but you're going to just, your body's going to explode, and you're going to go into a pit of hell.
Oh, these people are very impassioned. And well, Tim LaHaye.
Well, I'll tell you, Eric Zeus, to say they're impassioned, you are a nice man. I would have much crueler adjectives, but go ahead.
Okay. Tim LaHaye, co-founder of the Council for National Policy. It is a secret organization which was created basically by Tim LaHaye and other John Birch Society members, kind of like as a spin-off from the John Birch Society, but with a specifically fundamentalist Christian focus. The Birch Society was fundamentalist Christian itself, but this was harder right, in a sense, than the Birch Society.
Well, you're almost talking, if you're saying harder right than John Birch Society, you're talking fascist.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Basically, their agenda is for biblical law, the United States under biblical law. These people are very critical of democracy because democracy is man-made law. And the Council for National Policy is dedicated to the America living under Christian law, the law of the Bible. And there is a, in fact, several of the members of the Council for National Policy have written books and articles justifying slavery, and because it is accepted and authorized by the Bible, and even the New Testament refers to Christians as slaves of God. So, in other words, slavery is represented by some of these people as being part of this return, they would say, of the United States to being a Christian nation.
Well, that's the way it was before the Civil War, and they used the Bible to justify slavery. Well, this is totally, absolutely shocking. It's sort of the Christian version of Shia, the Islamic law. And,
Sharia.
Sharia
law. Exactly.
Sharia law, yeah, right.
These people are looking exactly for the same thing. In other words, they are, on the Christian end, very, very similar to what the proponents of Sharia law are in Islam. And they see George W. Bush as their leader. George W. Bush, according to all accounts, received a standing ovation when he solicited their endorsement and support on October 9th of 1999. And a tape had been made of that speech, and the Bush campaign asked for it to be destroyed, which it was. But fortunately, I was able to locate elsewhere what the questions are that, because they have a formal questionnaire that all candidates who solicit their endorsement must answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to find that the first question on that questionnaire has to do with whether or not the candidate supports the United States being submitting itself to biblical law. In other words, to the law of the Bible. And obviously, George Bush must have committed himself to that.
Well, George Bush just spoke in front of these Amish and said that he believes that God speaks through him. That's extraordinarily dangerous, if it's dangerous psychologically for anyone to say, and it's dangerous for a democratic nation to have somebody thinks that his choices are divinely inspired. So does he see himself as the leader of this sort of movement, in your estimation, Eric?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, he has, according to some sources, which I quote in the book, he has committed himself to this objective. And not only that, but he has committed himself to it in the full Council for National Policy sense, which is to say that the United States should control the world. In other words, the United States is God's nation. We are God's people. That is, that Christ-believing Americans are God's people. And essentially they are calling for a restoration of the Holy Roman Empire, only ruled from Washington, D.C., instead of from Rome. Hmm. And they have called George Bush their leader, and they have said that their leader is in the White House. And among the people who, among the members of this organization, are not only well-known Republicans like Trent Lott and Dick Armey and some aristocratic families, including the DuPonts and the Hunts and the Coors, but many other less well-known, very hard right families. And their agenda is essentially for an American empire. And this also means to evangelize and spread the gospel of Christ throughout the world. And consequently, there were large numbers of fundamentalist Christian evangelicals who were massed on the border, the Jordanian border, right prior to the invasion of Iraq. The people loaded up with thousands of Bibles. And this was not well reported, not reported at all in the mainstream press. But they were looking to follow right behind the conquest of Iraq with conversion of the Iraqi people.
You know, Eric Zeus, we only have about 90 seconds left, so we're going to have to get the rest of this story from your important book, Iraq War, The Truth. Eric Zeus, last name is spelled Zeus-S-E.
S as in Sam, S as in Sam E.
Yeah. And how can we get the book? What's it?
It's in bookstores, but you'll probably have to ask for it since other media have not reviewed it or covered it. Bookstores can only find it on their computer system, and then you can order it from any bookstore.
Well, I'll tell you, Eric, I know lots of talk show hosts around the country, and there we are in a lot of ways awash in books about Iraq and the reasons for the invasion. This section, though, of your book about the role played by the Christian right, I think is extraordinarily unique and a danger to our democracy, because George W. Bush has laughingly said, he laughs, at least after, on four separate occasions, my favorite form of government is a dictatorship, and he kind of...
So long as I am the dictator.
As the dictator. Well, I think this is our obligation to make sure that democracy doesn't get squeezed, but rather that extends. So I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us. Is there a website we can go to for Delphic Press?
Well, actually, there is not, no. But if you order the book through your bookstore, you can look at it and decide whether to buy it. I should mention that the pre-publication endorsements on the back cover are very, very enthusiastic. The world's leading authority on international law, Richard Falk of Princeton University,
wonderful man,
said the book is devastating. It should be read by everyone. It's an important work.
All right,
there are numerous others.
Eric, time is devastating us. I want to thank you so much for having joined me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you.
You are listening to WRIF.com. Hey, it's Mike Walters from The Morning Show, and I'm as excited as you are that summer is officially here. Summer, of course, means hot weather, but extreme temperatures can really affect your car's transmission, and you certainly don't need a breakdown in the middle of a summer road trip or when you're rolling around town with your buds. So if you're hearing any grinding, feeling slipping, seeing fluid, or think you might have a transmission problem, visit one of AAMCO's four locations in the Detroit area. Call 1-800-GO-AAMCO, that's A-A-M-C-O, for the center nearest you. Tell them I sent you for a free diagnostic check at participating centers. Just call for an appointment. AAMCO technicians are the best in the field. They're trained and certified in advanced transmission diagnosis, repair, and maintenance. So taking your car to AAMCO is like having vacation insurance. And with the skyrocketing gas prices, a better running car means better gas mileage. For a job done right, guaranteed, at a price that's right, AAMCO, AAMCO.
Getting ready to move into your new home? Got a business to relocate? Need help moving and packing delicate or fragile stuff? For your moving needs, don't bother calling the middleman when you can go straight to the boss. The professionals at Boss Moving and Service. Boss Moving and Service has been family owned and operated for over 20 years. They specialize in local moving with a fleet of 9 trucks. They carry a full line of packing materials. They're licensed by the state and fully insured. Boss is also your home and business relocation specialist. Whether it's one item, a piano, or organ, maybe a delicate antique or an entire truckload. Whatever you need to make your move go smoother, Boss Moving and Service has you covered. Compare Boss Moving's low prices to the other guys, and you'll learn what others in Metro Detroit have known for years. Don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss. Call the professionals at Boss Moving and Service toll-free at 800-706-6644. Call today for a free in-home estimate at 800-706-6644. Remember, don't mess with the middleman. Go straight to the boss.
This is WRIM.com.
Hello, how are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked to Gene Simmons of KISS. Of course, we had to ask about Peter and our dear friend Ace.
Now, they're both sweethearts. Hopefully, they're taking care of their health, which is more important than being on tour in a rock band.
Well, there's just so many comical aspects to him also. Just the business of him, that he likes to take things apart, but he rarely puts them back together again. And
never puts them back together. I've given him a few cell phones. You know, if they didn't, if they had a click or something, yeah, let me fix it. He tears them apart. I'm going, oh, that's what the inside looks like.
Yeah.
I'm going, okay, can I have it back? It's not working.
Not a chance. Not a chance. There's no way that cell phone's going back together again.
You don't let him do that in your studio, do you?
I stopped letting him do lots of stuff.
Drew and Mike in the Morning. Broadcast program. On the Riff.
101.1.
Riff. Rocks.
Twice is nice.
Double your
fun. New for Tuesday on the Riff.
Everyone, listen up.
Every Tuesday, 101 WRIF,
the home of rock and roll,
brings you Two for Tuesday. Keep it locked on the Riff all day this Tuesday for back-to-back badass blasts of your favorite riff rock band.
Plus, the Riff gives you the...
Joining me, pleasure to be with you. I was thinking just a little while back, my wife and I, about 10 or 15 years ago, took a number of long train trips and with sleepers, one via in Canada, another one we went from Detroit to Santa Fe, and how much we enjoyed it all. And just vaguely in the back of my mind, I realized that there were these men, African-American men, who used to be porters on trains quite a while ago. They figure in our history, and they come up, and you might see them like in 1940s movies. They're very obsequious, yes, you know, here, you know, very kind of these 30s and 40s stereotype of black men and how subservient they had to be to the white travelers. Well, there's an incredible book has just come out about that, the whole story. It's called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters in the Making of the Black Middle Class. It takes up a variety of subjects, everything from segregation to labor unions to jazz. And the author is Larry Tai. He's with me from Boston. He's a longtime reporter for the Boston Globe, and when he was working there, he won numerous awards. He now directs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists and the author of a number of other books. You can go to Larry Tai, TYE.com. Larry Tai, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Great to be with you, Peter.
You know, this is kind of the cheesiest question to begin with, but you know, how did you get interested in this? This doesn't seem like something that would just immediately pop to the mind of a Boston Globe reporter.
It wasn't. I actually got interested in it 10 years ago when I did a wonderful
year away from the globe as part of something called the Nieman Fellowship at Harvard University. And it's where 12 American and 12 foreign journalists are invited in to spend a year doing anything they want. And I had a professor who thought that the Pullman Porter story was an all-American success story, and he knew very little about it, but he knew enough to get me intrigued. And every year over the last 10 years, I started doing a little exploration, and every year I get back to him and talk to him about it. And finally, 3 years ago, I decided that this was worthy of trying to write a book about it, and I spent an entire year traveling the country looking for these ancient surviving Pullman Porters.
Why are they ancient surviving? It's because they don't exist anymore, right?
Exactly. Partly they don't exist anymore, and they haven't existed. The Pullman Company went out of business in 1968, and for the 30 years before it went out of business, travel had been so slow on the trains, and cars and planes were displacing trains, that for 30 years they hadn't hired a new porter. So you go back to 68 when the company went out of business, and then 30 years before that, since they had hired any sizable numbers of new porters, and you realize that the porters who are alive today are all in their late 80s, those are the youngsters, most of them are in their mid-90s, and one who I talked to was 102 when I talked to him, and is 104 today.
Boy. Well, the reason, I'll tell you, honestly, Larry Tye, the reason I set this up, saying this is about segregation, this is about labor unions, this is about jazz, and we can get into those subjects, on the face of it, probably someone hearing this, and did you have any fear that someone would say, Pullman Porters in the making of the black middle class, they'd think, boy, that's not going to be very exciting. But actually, it is very exciting. How do you, in the book, communicate those incredible social strands that are all brought together in Rising from the Rails?
It was easy because I was so excited about it. And anybody, it's sort of interesting because anybody who is over 40 probably remembers traveling on the cars. And part of the experience of going across country on a train was this sense of adventure and romance. You were out there for 3 or 4 days. You could do anything from watch the country go by, to eat and drink incredible food and drink, to many people ended up in the berth of somebody other than their spouse on this great adventure traveling across country. And so people remember that as a good time. And part, as you were saying in opening this, part of the image, the symbolism of those train trips was this obsequious porter in the background. And so I don't have to. I'm amazed how I don't have to tell people over a certain age why they ought to care about the whole Pullman experience. For younger people who have never really done much on the train, they remember and they know trains only through the movies and maybe through books they read. And they're intrigued by the idea of the story of race and sort of the racial tensions that played out on the train. I interest them by talking about the story of the birth of the civil rights movement. If they care about jazz or blues, there are wonderful stories about how music made its way across country via the Pullman Porters. Their story is in miniature so many bigger stories that I was so excited about it, and I try to convey that excitement in the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, the big stories, of course, in the movies were these glamorous white Hollywood movie stars, and it was just this, the porters were these black men with these huge grins moving at the whim of the travelers. But beneath it all, of course, there's a whole subculture of the repressed. And maybe you could even take it from the beginning. Who were the original porters? Now, the Pullman Company began, what, after the Civil War, right?
A year after the Civil War, and this incredible entrepreneur named George Pullman was out there trying to convince Americans that it was worth spending twice the normal price of a train ticket to ride in his elegant sleeping cars. And he knew that the fact that he had the finest craftsmanship and wonderful chandeliers and great food was not enough to bring people on board. He knew he had to give them the perfect service administered by the perfect servant. And he was smart enough to know that the embodiment of the perfect servant was the just freed slaves. He knew he could get these guys at incredibly low prices, barely paying them a living wage. He knew they'd work long hours, and they ended up working 400 hours a month. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, he knew that to wealthy and even more to middle-income travelers who had never experienced slavery, that the idea that they would have a servant who had been trained on plantations how to provide the perfect service, this was more than he could resist, and he didn't resist. He hired only ex-slaves, and as one porter said, he was looking for the blackest men with the whitest smiles.
Wow. Well, not sort of an inauspicious beginning, to be sure. Usually, from what I've read of history, the outward subservience to whites was dictated by what was necessary to survive financially, sometimes even physically. Yet these men must have been uncomfortable in their roles, or were they?
Well, in fact, they were uncomfortable in their roles, but they never showed it to their passengers. What they did was, George Pullman understood that if he paid them slightly less than what it took to live, that they would depend on the passengers for tips. They'd need those tips to survive, and therefore they'd be willing to do anything that a passenger asked of them, including absorb incredible abuse. They were called the N-word. They were called boy. And worst of all, they were called a name that every porter was called at some point, and generally every day in their careers, they were called George. They were called George because of a really insidious tradition passed on from slavery, where the slave was named after the slave master, and they were presumed to be George Pullman's slaves.
Now, did the white passengers know this, or, how was this communicated, that you would call any any porter George?
The same way all kinds of terrible traditions are passed down, that they heard it so often when they were on the train that some passengers presumed that that must be their name or what they were called, wanted to be called. Others had much less noble motives or less innocent motives. Whatever the derivation of it, they never bothered to ask, what's your real name? And this was a source of perpetual humiliation, and yet they had to bear it because they needed the tips.
And the tip system, how did that function? I mean, in other words, you have to look like you like your work, right? You enjoy serving
exactly.
The passenger. Yeah.
You have to look like you like your work. You have to do things that were not part of your official job responsibility, like shine shoes and whisk jackets clean when passengers are about to leave. And there was an informal system that grew up that people understood that there were certain tips for a certain number of days on the train, that it might be a nickel if a porter carried a couple bags for you, and a quarter for every day in the train, and this was not left to chance. Emily Post spelled it out in her books of etiquette, exactly what kind of tip was required for what kind of service, but there were certain people who were known as terrific tippers, and they were called fish, and there were certain people who were known as terrible tippers, and they were called snakes. And there were certain American presidents that we know about who fit into the fish and the snake category.
The book is Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters in the Making of the Black Middle Class. My guest is Larry Tye and the Peter Werby Show. The book is published by Henry Holt. This system with ex-slaves, this must have ended, say, 30 years after the Civil War or so, around the turn of the century. What kind of changes occurred when you no longer had ex-slaves, but rather the sons of ex-slaves?
The changes were only modest. The conditions got better, but not much better. George Pullman was known for being a really tough taskmaster. He survived until almost the end of the 19th century, and he beat back every attempt by the porters to try to form a union or to try to raise their wages or lower their number of working hours. And basically, going into the new century, into the 1900s, they were only slightly better off than the actual ex-slaves had been, and there was this perpetuation of a system of really tough rule.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 1884, there's a famous strike that was led by Eugene V. Debs, and the porters were not organized, right? The railroad
right.
workers struck Pullman.
In 1894, the railroad
94,
workers
rather,
struck.
Yeah.
Yes, and it was white railroad workers who struck, and they never asked the porters to join in the strike. They never had any interest in having black workers join them, and they learned, the porters and the white railroad workers who struck learned a very tough lesson. They were George Pullman called in the Chicago police, the Illinois State Militia, and federal troops to put down the strike, and after the strike, he ended up firing lots of the workers who struck, and that was a sign of just how tough he was going to be when the porters tried to unionize. And they did, and the man who succeeded George Pullman at the Pullman Company was every bit as tough as George Pullman was, and he was Abe Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln.
Well, that's amazing. Eventually, the porters did unionize, right? When did that occur?
That began, their drive for union in terms of that last successful effort began in 1925. It took almost to the day 12 years to succeed. And in 1937, the Pullman Company shocked the porters that they were bargaining with and came in and said, we will sign a contract. That basically the porters had watched hundreds of their fellow workers be fired. They had watched several of their leaders being beaten up. They had watched the Pullman Company try to bribe, essentially, black ministers, other community leaders, to try to get them to oppose the porters' attempts to unionize. And it was only through astounding persistence that they managed to beat all this back and in 1937 sign the first contract. They were the most successful black trade union in the history of America.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is interesting that they were so persistent, as you put it, Larry Tye, because certainly what happened to them also happened to white workers during the 1920s and certainly into the 1930s, where as many as 300 people forming unions and in strikes were killed by police and by troops. And yet Pullman workers, the porters, the African-American men, this was the plum of employment, am I correct?
It was.
And to risk that was almost a risk all.
It was absolutely the plum job. The expression in the black community for much of the early 1900s was that the two best jobs a black man could have were Pullman or postal. Meaning if you work for the post office, you got a nice uniform, no back-breaking work, and decent money. And the only thing better than that in the blue-collar world back then was being a Pullman porter, because you got all those things. You got a nice uniform, decent money eventually, and not back-breaking work, but you also got to see the country. And they were the only black males who got to, as part of their normal job, see America.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the leader at the time of 1937 of the recognition by the Pullman Company of the Porters Union, A. Philip Randolph, was he also, I know he was very prominent almost immediately, but was he the leading unionist?
He was. He was the guy who they hired in 1925. He was not a Pullman porter. They hired him because he was not a Pullman porter and because he was talented. They knew that if they hired a porter, he'd be fired immediately. So they got this outside guy for 12 years, Randolph, earning next to nothing and getting astounding grief. At one point, the Pullman Company actually gave him a blank check. And basically, the great legend, and it seems to be true, was they told him, you fill in any amount you want, just go away for a long vacation. And partook their payoffs. He never was dissuaded. And after 12 years, he got them a union.
Well, and he was and always very radical in terms of racial issues, because if I remember right, he was the one that had proposed the March on Washington in, was it 1941, for racial equality?
He did. It was actually in the late 1930s that he proposed the first March on Washington, and it was then in 1941 he went to Roosevelt and actually said, we are going to march unless you give us some things that we want, and he had a list of demands. He got the demands from Roosevelt, and it turned out that it took a full 25 years for them to actually march on Washington. When they did in 1965, it was again Randolph, who had been around since the 1920s. In 1965, he was chairman of the enormous March on Washington, where Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech.
Mm-hmm.
And Randolph was, I like to say that if Martin Luther King was the father of the civil rights movement, A. Philip Randolph was the grandfather.
Well, let's talk about that, how the Pullman porters influenced the civil rights strike and or civil rights movement, rather. And I should reintroduce you in your book. Larry Tye is my guest. The book we're talking about is Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters. These were the men who were did service on the black men who did service on the trains through 1968. And Pullman Porters in the Making of the Black Middle Class. The book is available from Henry Holt. So put them in a context. Well, already we have A. Philip Randolph as a union leader and having the ear of the Roosevelts Eleanor and Franklin in Washington. But what role did they play even back before they were unionized?
Sure. Can I tell you a quick story about
sure.
The story is when we think of the birth of the civil rights movement in America, we generally think of the Montgomery bus boycott. And all your listeners know the story. Rosa Parks was told to go back to the colored section of the bus. There was a seat in the white section, the only seat available, and she took that. She was arrested for doing that, and everybody knows that she was taken down to the local jail. What they don't know is that in addition to calling up her husband to come down and bail her out, she called up a man named Edgar D. Nixon. And Nixon was a Pullman porter, and she called Nixon because Nixon was her boss. She was the secretary at his office of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He also ran the local chapter of the NAACP. And he had been planning for years that somebody like Parks would be arrested, and they'd be able to use it as a test case to generate a bus boycott. So the very next morning after he bailed her out, Nixon's on the phone to 19 black ministers in town, inviting them to a meeting. The third minister he called is a young guy who just came to Montgomery from Boston named Martin King. And he says, "Reverend King, will you come to a meeting to talk about a bus boycott?" And King was young and cautious, and he said, "I'll think about it. Call me back." So Nixon, after he calls all the rest of the ministers, calls back King and says, "Will you come?" And King says, "Okay, I'll come." Nixon says, "That's good, because I've invited 18 other ministers to be at your church at 3 o'clock tomorrow." Nixon himself, as King acknowledged in his autobiography, would have run the bus boycott, except he was a Pullman porter who was out on the road. I tell you the story because the guy behind the most critical starting event of the civil rights movement was a Pullman porter, and that's a metaphor for the role the porters played from the earliest days. They were the ones who donated union halls to have civil rights meetings. Their money bankrolled the early civil rights movement, and their leaders, people like E.D. Nixon and A. Philip Randolph, were critical behind-the-scenes people in the early days of the civil rights movement, and they were orchestrating things. And they had learned, through their long struggle against the Pullman Company, how to fight a powerful white interest, and it was a perfect training for the civil rights movement.
Larry Tye, I think another fascinating part of your book, Rising from the Rails, and you indicated it somewhat in talking about how these black men who, if they hadn't been porters, probably would have been stuck in some Delta town or maybe in a slum in Detroit or Chicago, yet were able to travel all over the country. And there was this enormous migration from the South to the North in the teens, and all these people left these areas in the South, brought cultural forms like jazz up with them. Did the porters themselves play a distinct role in all that?
They played a critical role in that. It was porters who brought newspapers from cities like Chicago. They delivered newspapers like the Chicago Defender, the leading black paper in those days in Chicago, and other newspapers into small towns and hamlets in the South. These newspapers were proclaiming how much better life was in the North. It was the Pullman porters who, by their very presence and by talking to people, talked about what it was like for them living in Chicago or New York or Boston. They were the conduit for information, and they were the personal embodiment of why life could be better for blacks in the North, and they were very convincing, and they helped fuel, you can't say they did it alone, but they helped fuel the migration, millions of blacks moving from the South to the North, changing the geography of both regions.
Now, you know, as a Euro-American, I find myself sometimes when I've done reporting on issues involving African-Americans, and I've gone to, there's a fact that's just coming up now, a historical marker is being put at the home of Ossian Sweet, who was defended his home to, now I'm such an expert on it, I'm forgetting the date, I think it was 1925, and Ossian Sweet, a dentist and his friends, defended the home with rifles. A mob attacked the house, and a man was killed, and it was Clarence Darrow, the famous defense lawyer's last case. And I know I went to that house, and I always thought, I wonder if these people that live in the house now, because I was asking them, did they know about the house, and they sure did. I'm wondering what they were thinking. Gee, what is this white boy interested in all this? Did you have any sense of that when you interviewed these elderly ex-porters?
I had a perpetual sense of that. I would show up on the doorstep of the 40 porters and dining car guys that I was interviewing, and I would get, these guys were much too polite to ever say anything. They were, by definition, the ultimate gentleman. But I'd get the sense that they had expected a black guy, that when I called them on the phone to set up an interview, we never talked about race, but they just presumed that I would be black. And so I show up there, white guy, and for the first 15 minutes of every interview, I got a sense they were very wary about why I was there and why I wanted to be part of telling their story. 15 minutes into the interview, things began to transform, and it happened every interview. And I could have been green and come from the planet Mars. I was the guy who was there to tell their story, and race sort of disappeared as a factor.
Mm-hmm.
They knew they were old. They knew that probably nobody else was going to come around asking for their story, and it was me or nobody, so better me.
Well, why? I mean, I can quickly tell you why my interest was. My interest is always in extending democracy and the idea of people bravely defending themselves against mobs, whether it was black people or other people who were under assault. I would be, I'd love to be able to tell that story. Was there something like that in your motivation?
It was precisely that. This was exactly the kind of, as I mentioned at the beginning, all-American story. This was men who started with not only nothing, they started as ex-slaves with truly nothing, and how they helped shape opportunity for their race. And they clearly didn't do it alone. There were ministers, there were teachers whose kids went on and did other things, but Pullman porters played such a strategic role in forming the black professional class that it was a story I couldn't resist.
Here I'm talking about how grand I am, patting myself on the back about extending democracy, and I never even asked you. In fact, I've said the word men so many times. Were there women involved in this struggle?
Good question, and the answer was, for one brief period, there were porterettes, but it was basically, there were women absolutely involved in the struggle, but not on the trains. It was the porters and their wives who played absolutely critical roles, but on the trains, other than this brief period of maids and porterettes, it was basically a man's job and a black man's job.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's still sleeping cars. I mean, I'm trying to think when I last was on one, maybe like the early 80s, so 20 years ago. I assume they're still there. Why did the porters disappear?
The porters disappeared in terms of the black monopoly. There are still porters on the sleeping cars. It's a different world. It's a rainbow world. The good news is today a black man can become a conductor or can take any job on the railroad. In those days, the good news was that blacks had a monopoly on the job of Pullman porter. The bad news was they couldn't be promoted from that job. So one of the things they gave up when they got the opportunity for promotion was the exclusive right to call all Pullman porter jobs blacks jobs.
Well, I remember when we were on these trains, my wife and I, and had sleeping cars, that you certainly did not get any sense of obsequiousness, submissiveness on the people on the part of the people that were taking down the bunks or you know, bringing us stuff. So certainly that culture, fortunately, is long gone. Go ahead. We got about 10 or 15 seconds left. If you have
sure.
A final
the thing. Good news is that culture is gone. The bad news is when I tried to talk to Amtrak porters about the old days of the porters, they know nothing about that story. So the culture is gone, and unfortunately the story is disappearing too.
Let's get them this book. Larry Tye is my guest. You can go to LarryTye.com, T-Y-E. com, and the book is published by Henry Holt. It's Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. A pleasure to have talked with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to the Riff's Night Call. Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed in the show do not necessarily reflect those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio or Greater Media Detroit. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby. Now stay tuned for more Riff Rock, coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Okay, so now my friend Barry wants to buy a motorcycle, a really big motorcycle, but he's a working guy, trying like me to pinch his pennies. Then all our friends told Barry, buy a bike at Motown, buy a bike at Motown. So Barry, who stays home nights pinching his pennies, thinks he can get the better deal if he shops the competition. Those other dealers showed him what he could get with his pennies. And then his head explodes. Then I take my friend Barry to Motown, Harley Davidson, and Taylor. They tell him, big used police buy, save today. And he says, no way. And they say, save today. And he says, no way. And they say, save today. And Larry says, okay. And now we are riding our Harleys, and Barry has his macho, macho motorcycle and didn't have to part with all his pennies. The end.
mind.
For sales, specials, events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley-Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph, just north of Eureka.
Remember, guys, chicks like a guy on the Rio motorcycle. Buy a bike at Motown! Okay.
It's party time. Get a real feel of erotic image featuring Michigan's hottest male and female strippers.
Erotic Image. Add a stripper to any party and watch your friend come alive.
Erotic Image delivers the sexiest and most seductive entertainers right to your doorstep or wherever the party's at.
For your next bachelor, bachelorette, birthday, or any party occasion, give the gift that unwraps itself. Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, the name that says it all. Sexy, provocative, outrageous, but all in good fun.
Erotic Image, 888-41-STRIP.
Surf Erotic Image at eroticimage.com, the official home of Brutal Betty, the Erotic Image Dream Girls, the incredible hunks of Men in Motion, and those naughty awesome twosomes, the wild girly girls. Due to popular demand, Erotic Image has hosts and hostesses to kick off your party. Try one.
Go online and explore the Erotic Image Cyber Showcase. View the dancers, check the prices, and place your order online.
Erotic Image, where image is expertise, and the experience is always erotic.
Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP. That's 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, where image is everything.
What makes Bell Tire people happy?
I'm Tom Berry, and I'm a Bell Tire manager. Great relationships with customers make me happy.
I know about a lot of things, but tires and auto service, I've had experiences that really turned me off. So I'm glad a friend turned me on to Bell Tire. They're friendly, helpful, and more than just tires. I also bring my car here for service, and they do a great job. They make me feel comfortable.
At Bell Tire, you'll find only the best people in the business. Experts will help you find exactly what you need. And ASE-certified technicians who will get the job done right. From tires to brakes, alignments, shocks, struts, and more. Plus, you'll get our guaranteed everyday lowest out-the-door prices. No extras ever. Free valve stems, mounting, balancing, and tire disposal.
I love out-the-door pricing. No hidden extras, and I always get a great deal.
I'm Tom Berry. Trust me. You'll be happy you came in.
That's a promise.
Bell Tire.
Bell Tire has only ASE certified mechanics and all the best brand names like Kelly, Goodyear, and Michelin in stock. All at the guaranteed lowest out-the-door prices every day. Hurry in to Bell Tire today.
It's back. It's bigger than ever. And it brings all new meaning to renew, reuse, recycle.
Let's go take our empties to the store.
Yeah. No, no, no. Guys, I'm talking about the homemade bikini contest at Wild Woody.
Oh, yeah!
Now, the competition really gets wild as Metro Detroit's most gorgeous women clash for the championship of the summer. It's the finals of the homemade bikini contest. Get ready to rumble with your host, The Riff's Doc of Rock, Doug Podell, this Wednesday night as the most beautiful women in the Motor City show off their stuff in the homemade bikini contest finals. For cash, prizes, and championship bragging rights. Wild Woody's turns the heat up on summer. It's the creme de la creme, the best of the best, competing in the homemade bikini contest finals at Wild Woody's.
The most outrageous people, the hottest beats, and an insane atmosphere that you won't find anyplace else.
Come early and stay late for Metro Detroit's hottest dance party.
Ladies 18 and over, welcome.
Hook up with wig and drink specials all night long. Served up by the wildest wait staff in town. And here you thought summertime couldn't get any hotter. It's the homemade bikini contest finals this Wednesday night at Wild Woody's in Roseville.
Sponsored by Jade's Closet and by Rose Talent Agency.
Wild Woody's on Gresham in downtown Roseville.
For more information, call the Wild Woody's Wildline at 586-294-5331.
Wild Woody's.
Riff Rock. Next.
Walt Michael Army Center, the ultimate recreational superstore.
Do you have a case of RV envy? Hi, Christine Michael here for Walt Michael's RV Superstore. It's camping season in Michigan, and it's time when many people experience a severe case of RV envy. That's when you pull up to your campsite and park right next to a brand new RV that's a lot bigger than your unit. That's when it hits you. You've got RV envy. Well, at Walt Michael's RV, we have a cure for all types of RV envy. With over 900 RVs in stock, we're sure you'll find an RV that will make all your neighbors jealous. Cure your case of RV envy with a luxurious motorhome from Walt Michael's RV Superstores. Come and see us. We're on the North I-94 Service Drive in Belleville. Or call us at 800-697-2500. No matter how severe, Walt Michael's can cure your case of RV envy. We'll be looking for you.
Do you mind telling me what this is all about, Mr.?
Giving you back
to the Rock.
Quicker than anybody.
I'm always doing that.
101. The Rev.
Hey, what's up? This is Ann.
This is Ben.
I'm Mark from Breaking Benjamin, and you're listening to
Riff, the Motor City's rock station. Riff rocks Detroit.
hero circle.